You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Chris Williams. Chris wrote the book Ecology and Socialism, Solutions to Capitalist Ecological Crisis. He is a longtime environmental activist with a scientific background and has authored numerous articles on the science and politics of climate change and energy for various media outlets. He is a writer in residence at one of my favorite media outlets, truthout.org, and an educator and professor at Pace University in New York in the Department of Chemical and Physical Sciences. Chris Williams, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks very much for having me on your show.
So let's start with this. What happened at the climate conference in Paris? There are extremely divergent reports, to put it mildly.
Yes. And I mean, I think it's been hailed as historic by the people who signed off on it and wrote it, which is essentially government leaders, their advisors, and actually the corporations who helped to sponsor the conference itself, including some of the fossil fuel corporations largely responsible for getting us into this mess in the first place. And then at the other end of the spectrum, which I would argue is a more accurate representation of what actually happened, one can only say that this is really a historic deal if by historic you mean you've set the course for the planet to burn, essentially, because on the one hand, I think some environmentalist organizations, particularly the larger, more mainstream ones, have seen the 1.5 degree limit that all of the 190-odd countries have signed on to, and seen that as a step forward from the 2 degrees C limit that previously scientists had said, well, if we go above 2 degrees C of average global warming over this century, then, and we've already gone up one over the last 100 years or so, then that would be truly dangerous for human civilization and much of the rest of the biosphere upon which we all depend. And so that was lowered to 1.5, partly under new information from science and the way in which actually the climate could be more sensitive than we previously thought to changes in atmospheric composition of greenhouse gases, and also partly by the pressure created by activists to say we are not going to be buried under rising seas and we're not going to continue to see deforestation and so on. We're going to fight the system as a whole until you recognize that actually the people who are paying the highest price, the poor people around the world, people in the global south in particular, are not going to sit by and let you sign off on a deal that condemns much of us to not just misery, but death and mass migration and other giant existential questions and issues. So on the one hand, if you focus on that, then you can claim it as some kind of victory, and in some sense that's accurate. But then when you come to the implementation, okay, how are we going to achieve this goal? If we're no longer aiming for 2, but we're Celsius above the average pre-industrial temperature that we've had for the last 10,000 years, more or less, in other words, the whole of human civilization, if we're aiming for a harder target to achieve, how are we going to achieve that? And there is no sense, no plan, no realistic idea coming out of that conference as to how that could be achieved. Not even the 2, because the pledges that all of the countries put forward, there's 2 problems. One is that all of the pledges, if they do them, which is a giant if all the countries do what they say that they're going to do, then that actually puts us on track for 3 degrees C of warming, which would be truly catastrophic.
And they know that, or that's your calculation?
They know that. They are aware of that, and even in the treaty itself, actually it's not a treaty, it's a voluntary set of agreements. The other second large problem is nobody's going to be held accountable if they don't do the things that they say they're going to do. But the Obama, everybody who signed on is aware that what they signed on for is this plan that, as I mentioned earlier, will set the course for the planet to have catastrophic outcomes with regard to massively shifting the climate regime of the last 10,000 years into some new reality. So they're aware of that, and that's why they have this five-year kind of check-in. How are we doing? Should we ratchet up our ambitions? And everybody's saying, well, we have to ratchet up our ambitions, which is kind of self-evident. That is, I would say, highly unlikely, because Kyoto was legally binding in 1997, and as soon as countries saw that they were not going to be able to make what they declared, they just dropped out. Canada dropped out, Japan dropped out. Obviously, the U.S. never ratified it in the first place, because they knew that they would not be able to do it. So I think we haven't even got that in the new Paris Agreement, that governments might be shamed into doing something. They can simply, there's lots of ways in which they can obfuscate and get away with whatever they want to get away with. So I think there are huge problems.
I think you mentioned somewhere that some categories of major outlets of fossil fuel are not even included at all, including air travel and international shipping. Is that right?
Absolutely. There were some people who said the Copenhagen Accord in 2009, one of the previous rounds of negotiations, now 6 years ago, was in some ways, you could argue, better than Paris, because at least it included, that was where the kind of 2 degrees limit was first kind of proposed and taken up by politicians. That actually included air travel and international shipping. And the Paris Agreement explicitly excludes those two areas. And why is that important? Why is that significant? Because it's been calculated that the emissions from greenhouse gases by those two areas are equivalent to the emissions of Germany and the fifth largest economy in the world and Great Britain combined. And those emissions are set to increase, with all of the new trade deals, which are completely contrary to limiting greenhouse gas emissions in the first place. That's set to increase over the lifetime of this agreement, which only goes to 2030 anyway, by about 350%. That's the estimate. And so if you're saying that those are exempt, then you're giving away a huge segment of what we should be doing with regard to, and not just emissions, but in terms of what does that mean for where the world is going with commodity production, with international trade, with ways in which you're producing goods wherever they can be most cheaply produced, regardless of the ecological or the social ramifications. So that's one major omission. And then obviously the other major omission is nothing is said about the military, with the military, particularly the United States, being responsible for huge, not only vast amounts of actual death in the immediate sense, but also in the indirect sense, that they are responsible for a huge chunk of not just greenhouse gas emissions, but also toxic waste and, destroying the planet by dropping bombs all over it. So I think between those two areas, there are significant other limitations when you get into some of the details of the agreement itself.
Yeah, I saw somewhere someone calculated, I think this was based on around 2006, including the then very active war on Iraq, that the United States military alone would rank 30-something in a list of nations in terms of petroleum consumption. Does that sound right to you?
Yes, and it could be higher too, because it depends what you're doing. Military jets fly, obviously, not just frequently, but also very high and very fast. And that in itself is a more significant problem with regard to global warming. Then there's the military bases that are all over the world. About the U.S. has about 200 or so dotted around the place.
Many more than that, actually.
Yeah, that's a wild underestimate. The amount of waste and pollution that is created by those, aside from the ways in which, 80% of the energy use by the federal government is for the Department of Defense, for example. So the Pentagon is a huge consumer of fossil fuels, and clearly it's impossible to explain the invasion of Iraq without talking about where oil is found, and oil is directed towards the Pentagon in large quantities. So
are we talking about something higher than 3 degrees once you add in unrestricted militarism and air travel and international shipping?
Well, this depends. Because if they don't do anything, I mean, this is why people say, well, it's better than nothing, because if they don't do anything, then we could be going up to 4 or 5 Celsius. And if all these pledges are carried out, then we'll go up to 3. But 3 is already a completely different planet, and not in a good way, in terms of the continuing rise of the oceans, the acidification of the oceans, larger, longer droughts, more frequent and more severe storms, stronger cloud bursts with rain falling in extreme amounts in short periods of time or not falling. And obviously, human society for the last 10,000 years has depended on agriculture as its base. And so if we can't make predictions about where crops are going to be able to grow, what kind of crops, because we're unsure of rainfall patterns, and there are more devastating extreme weather events that destroy crops, then, and floods and so on, then that begins to create all kinds of dislocations in terms of mass migrations from various parts of the world. The United States obviously is a country many people think is perhaps more immune than others. On the one hand, that's true because money can be provided. It's the richest country in the world. On the other hand, the climatic extremes in the United States across the continent, I mean, we're seeing all kinds of, California being most famously, but North Carolina, the Northwest at the moment flooding. The wildfire season has already extended by days or weeks. How does this impact our ability to continue when we're having to rebuild all the time? We've already had to rebuild 2 of the most iconic cities in the world in terms of New Orleans in 2005 after Katrina and Hurricane Sandy in New York in 2012. So how many more times are you going to rebuild cities if this starts to become an annual event, for example? 3 degrees puts us on track for that, those kind of outcomes. And kind of when you go to 3 degrees, you're pretty much headed, you've lost control to a certain degree of our own destiny, in terms of, unless we can start bringing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, then, and bringing it down as opposed to just stopping putting more of it in there, then we could be heading to 4 and 5 without us doing anything over the next 200 or 300 years. So radically changing the planet to something that we haven't seen in tens of millions of years, when sea levels were 120 feet higher than they are now.
So if it were actually kept to 1.5, you might avoid some warming feedback loops that take it out of human control, whereas if it gets to 3, it's going to go to 4 or 5, and there's nothing you can do about it?
Quite possibly, because we don't know. Science is unable to answer the question because we've got no direct experience of this. And even looking into the past, which is our best indicator, and where we've found a lot of the things that we've so far found out in terms of past climates and warming that we know have existed on Earth, then we're not exactly sure, scientists are not exactly sure how sensitive it is, the climate. There could be other tipping points which we're approaching as we go from 2 to 3 Celsius, such as there are massive amounts of methane trapped in frozen land in the Arctic and in the tundra. And if that starts to, the permafrost starts to no longer be frozen all year round, then that methane, which is much more powerful than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas, will start leaking out. We're already seeing signs of that. So that's one huge worry. The other worry is that they're also trapped under the oceans, vast amounts of methane. It's frozen. And if as the oceans warm, perhaps those will start melting, basically, turning back into a gas and bubbling to the surface. And either of those outcomes, we're talking about vast increases in global warming gases, which would be, catastrophic over a short period of time.
Yeah.
And so, there are some unknowns. And the feedback loops become self-reinforcing. You melt more ice, and that exposes, in the Arctic, that exposes dark ocean or dark land. And so that then absorbs more heat from the sun. And then that melts more ice, which creates more dark ocean and land, which melts more ice, and so on and so forth. So that's an example of a positive feedback loop, where the change reinforces more of the change.
If the world weren't spending roughly $2 trillion a year on militarism, and roughly half of that the United States alone, and were to invest $2 trillion a year in renewable, sustainable energy, what sort of a difference could that level of spending make?
Well, I think that would make a gigantic difference. We're talking about $2 trillion on the military. We're talking about one of the most profitable businesses in the world, the arms industry, which the U.S. heads globally. We're also talking about everybody says, well, we can't afford the transition to renewable energy. We can't afford to build these wind turbines and solar panels. But we somehow managed to build plenty of tanks, airplanes, and battleships for, as you mentioned, $2 trillion a year, which then goes on to carry out all of the wars that we're seeing around the world and level of instability and violence. But there's another source of funding which is not reported very much, although the IMF has estimated this at several trillion dollars, the International Monetary Fund, which is subsidies and tax breaks, incentives to produce more fossil fuels. So between $3 and $5 trillion goes to the most profitable industries on the planet, the fossil fuel corporations, in order to have them produce more of the stuff that we know we need to keep in the ground. And so between the military and between subsidies to fossil fuels, you could easily transform the world economy with regard to energy production in terms of the kind of new infrastructure that we would need to make wind and solar viable across the planet, and with plenty of money left over too.
I might even throw taxing multi-billionaires in there as another potential source of money.
I think that, there's the massive decrease in taxes on the ultra-wealthy. I mean, it's not surprising that the wealthy have got even wealthier if you stop taxing them, and as we've done over the last 30 years or so. And then there's marketing. I mean, when you think about it, everybody says, well, everybody loves to go and buy things. Humans, we love this consumer culture. If that were true, why do they spend $1 trillion a year in the United States convincing us to spend and buy more of their mostly often worthless, poorly built products, deliberately poorly built? Just to give you a sense of scale, $1 trillion on marketing is twice the amount that's spent in the United States on all education, public and private, from kindergarten through graduate school. And so imagine if we just simply reversed that equation and cut marketing by half and doubled the education budget. What kind of schools would we be talking about here? So the money exists. It's just misdirected.
The United States even spends more on marketing the military per recruit than it spends on educating a student. But that $3 to $5 trillion a year in subsidies for fossil fuels, I wonder how much of that is in the United States, and I wonder what that says to the claims that fossil fuels are continuing their use because they're so profitable. Would they not be a little bit less profitable without the subsidies?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, the cheapest liquid that you can buy in the United States is gasoline, which when you think about the process that goes on, you have to dig it out of the ground, perhaps in the United States, but also anywhere else in the world, ship it somewhere, refine the thick black oil that can't be used for anything into all of the different products, one of which is gasoline, and then ship it somewhere else to be sold after you've gone through that whole process. And all of this takes enormous amounts of energy, enormous amounts of capital. Think about the infrastructure that exists to do that. And yet somehow it's still the cheapest liquid you can buy, cheaper than water, in the country. And so even with all those subsidies, wind energy is now compatible, is about the same price as oil and gas and coal. And so then you have to ask the question, well, it's true that investment in alternative renewable energy has increased, which is a good thing, but wind and solar are still only about 1.5% of the total energy production in the world. And so the level of transformation that needs to happen is still not happening within the time frame that we have. And so it's a bit more than just reversing the subsidies. Clearly, there's something else that we need to be talking about in terms of social power relations that force not just the building of wind and solar plants, but also the stopping exploring for coal, gas, and oil, because we know that 80% of what we already know exists, we can't burn, but they're still looking for more. And that is the other flaw in the Paris Agreement, in that there's no mention. Actually, in the 32-page document, they never mention fossil fuels once. They never mention oil. They never mention gas. They never mention coal. But these are the things you'd have to actually stop making and digging out of the ground if you really were serious about keeping the Earth as we've known it for all of human civilization.
And is the problem that if you were to switch the subsidies from the dirty energy to the clean energy, that it just couldn't be made as profitable for a bunch of corrupt oligarchs, and therefore you must develop a society that's not run by corrupt oligarchs? Or could it be as profitable and there's just a problem of inertia?
I think, I think that they, as long as you privatize the land and control of pricing and so on, and where the solar panels and the wind turbines are located, and who gets to sell the electricity coming from those, as long as you control that, then there's no reason why you couldn't set up a system to be profitable under capitalism. I mean, I think it's a bit more difficult, but then they managed it with, I mean, they managed to turn pollution into a tradable commodity, right? They managed to turn carbon dioxide into something they could make money from. So I'm quite sure that as ingenious as the capitalists are at figuring out how to fleece us, they'd work out how to market and sell us at a profitable rate the sun and the wind. I think it's more about the trillions of dollars that is already invested, the sunk capital costs, in the infrastructure of the production of fossil fuels. And that infrastructure, I mean, in the United States alone, for example, and this is the other thing, we're talking mostly about electricity production. There's far less forward momentum on the question of transportation. So almost all transportation is gasoline or diesel or heavy fuel oil or kerosene. And what is going to replace that? I mean, that's where we're talking about oil production, which currently is about 80 million barrels every day, which in itself is, I think, a staggering statistic. Every 24 hours, somewhere in the world, 80 million barrels of oil are dug out of the ground 365 days of the year. That is set to increase by 2020 to 110 or 120 million barrels rather than decrease. So what are we doing with regard to this massively wasteful, incredibly inefficient transportation system based on individual private cars driven by an internal combustion engine, which is about 10% efficient? So I think that as I mentioned, 180,000 gas stations in this country, hundreds of thousands of miles of pipelines, massive investment in refineries, all of the shipping, giant supertankers, the military there to protect those things, the oil wells, all of that represents sunk capital costs to the fossil fuel industry and also infrastructure that the governments of various countries built, and most oil is actually owned by states as opposed to private companies. So I think it's about the inertia, and about you've set up an energy system based on giant centralized plants, and wind and solar requires a very different type of infrastructure. And so you wouldn't just be talking about changing the type of fuel that you were getting the energy from, where you were getting the energy, but you'd also be talking about, well, differences in how do you store it, how do you transport it, how do people use it, what size power plants, is it on, you know, solar panels on individual houses, is it modular, is it decentralized, is it a mix of decentralized and centralized? Either way you slice that, you're going to be looking at a very different energy infrastructure and transportation network. So
We have like 1 minute left. I this may be unfair to try to ask, but in terms of what's happened in Copenhagen and in Paris, what has Barack Obama's role been?
I think his role has been to change the rhetoric, but not the reality. I think he certainly sounds a lot more invested than George W. Bush, but when you look at his actual policy, all of the above, what Paris did was replicate all of the above and expand it onto the international stage. So that's the Obama policy writ large. We will spend money on renewables, and we will set this totally unrealistic goal in terms of how they're going to achieve it, of 1.5 degrees C of warming, but we're going to continue to produce and ratchet up, actually increase fossil fuel production.
Chris Williams from truthout.org and Pace University. His book is Ecology and Socialism, Solutions to Capitalist Ecological Crisis. Chris, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, from community rallies around the country to the presidential election, the Black Lives Matter movement has changed the conversation. Keeping a spotlight on state-sanctioned violence against black people, activists have opened up a debate, including in corporate media, that addresses racism and white supremacy in ways more searching and less euphemistic than we're used to. At least fewer pundits tell us we're living in a post-racial society. That's a start. Counterspin frequently engages corporate media's role in issues of racial justice. We're going to revisit a few of those conversations on this week's show. We'll hear from UCLA professor and author Robin Kelly, from media activist Malkia Cyril of the Center for Media Justice, and from researcher and author Richard Rothstein of the Economic Policy Institute. That's all coming up on this week's Counterspin. Robin Kelly is Gary B. Nash Professor of American History at UCLA and author of Africa Speaks, America Answers, Modern Jazz in Revolutionary Times, among other titles. We spoke with him in July 2013 after the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the shooting death of unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin. Counterspin's Peter Hart asked about Kelly's contention that it was really Martin and not Zimmerman who was on trial.
Yeah, Trayvon Martin was always the one on trial because the question became, did he actually have a right to be there? Did he look suspicious? In other words, was racial profiling actually justifiable given not just the recent burglaries in the neighborhood, but just the whole conception of African Americans and Latinos, in this particular case, young black men being a threat and actually embodying criminality? You know, this is something that the jury bought. And in fact, what I find really curious is that for all the debates about the jury instructions and stand your ground, the one instruction that they got long before they entered the courtroom was who's a predator and who has a right to sort of own property and be present. And in some ways, George Zimmerman became the protector of the neighborhood. No matter what Trayvon Martin's relationship was to that community, he was always going to be the outsider. And that's how he was tried.
And there is this deep history, and you go through it in the column that you wrote, that to not be surprised by this verdict is just an acknowledgement that we have seen things like this happen again and again. The circumstances are not always exactly the same, but there is this commonality.
Right. It is like deja vu. It's amazing. If you just take 2012, 136 black people were shot and killed by police or vigilantes, unarmed people. 313 were killed altogether by state or state-sanctioned violence. If you take the whole history of just the last 25 years, if I start naming names, we'll be here for 3 or 4 hours. And in many cases, whether state-sanctioned violence or vigilante violence, a very similar scenario. You have an all-white jury or predominantly white jury. Police officers, vigilantes are acquitted. And usually the defense for the shooter is that their life was in danger. They thought the person had a gun. There was evidence that they most likely were about to commit a crime. And so this has happened over and over again. This is why one of my concerns is that if we focus politically so much on standing ground laws, which I think we should, it's very important, what ends up happening is that once we eliminate the laws, we think we've solved the problem. But this kind of violence and these kinds of verdicts long predate stand your ground, because stand your ground was already embedded in the system, in the culture, from the beginnings of the nation. You know, that is, that those who represent a kind of settler colonial reality, the folks who came here and settled and occupied the land, were the ones who laid claims to the land, laid claims to citizenship, and everyone else is a predator or a threat to property or property.
You know, one of the more frustrating aspects of some of the analysis has been seeing people almost speak past each other. There's this strictly legalistic framework that argues that there was no other verdict that could be reached based on the law in Florida and the evidence at hand. And that can be used, and I've seen it, used to stifle discussions of broader issues of racism and racial justice. Zimmerman could not be found guilty, and all of these other issues are being grafted onto an imperfect case. This is the work of what the Washington Post editorial page called hucksters and political demagogues, that we can't talk about race and racism unless a pure example comes along where there's no ambiguity.
Right. It's a weakness in the analysis because these are not contradictory positions. I read a piece recently, I think it was in Huffington Post, where someone was arguing that you got to take race out of it because the real issue centers on the jury instructions and standing ground laws, when in fact the reason we have standing ground laws has a lot to do with race and privilege and the way the criminal justice system is set up. So the thing is, you can do both. You can make the argument that ALEC-supported laws are dangerous, need to be repealed, need to be challenged. You can make the argument that the prosecution made a terrible mistake by not making race a center point of their argument when the defense actually did that. But this ends up, if you leave it there, you end up sort of, you know, kind of picking beans, when in fact, if we don't look at the larger structural issues, we can't begin to solve the problem, because this is a problem that goes back, you know, 150 years.
You know, the Washington Post columnist Richard Cohen created quite a bit of controversy over this because he wrote a column essentially defending racial profiling. Following young black men around just makes sense, and stopping and frisking them makes sense because they're the ones who are committing crime. And I thought it was so telling because an establishment voice could make this explicitly racist appeal based on, as you put in your column, based on this assumption that black men are up to no good, so you have to keep an eye on them. And of course, his response was, "Don't you dare call me a racist." What do the discussions of this trial and those kinds of conversations tell us about quote-unquote post-racial America?
Well, post-racial America means, I'll quote a friend of mine, Eduardo Bonilla Silva, who wrote a very important book, which talks about racism without racism. This is not a new phenomenon, but what it basically means is that by claiming that there's objective evidence, right, that certain people engage in certain kinds of behaviors or that it's cultural, you basically say, well, I'm not being racist, I'm just sort of looking at the facts. Post-racial means that we're not going to have a racial analysis of racial justice or injustice. In other words, we're going to eliminate race altogether, and that itself is a racial argument. Because what happens is Richard Cohen's kinds of claims depend on associating a small group of people's behavior with the entire group. Now, if we took the same logic, then you know, any older white man with a gun should be considered a threat, as in the case of this kid who was killed in Milwaukee. There's no way that any behavior on the part of white people, even if it's a minority, would be then projected onto the whole, quote-unquote, race. But the same thing happens for black and brown people, for Arabs. So racial profiling is always about non-white people because whiteness is considered the norm. Post-racialism is about acknowledging that there's only one legitimate citizenry, and that is those who are the settlers. Everyone else has to prove their citizenry, their worth, their value, and the fact that they're not dangerous. I mean, this is sort of where we are, and we accept it because we think it's making us safer, you know, and it's not. It actually has the very opposite, and it undermines democracy in some very, very direct ways that are dangerous not just for people of color, but for everybody.
We've been speaking with Robin Kelly. His column on this, The U.S. versus Trayvon Martin, The System Worked, appeared at numerous outlets, including Counterpunch. Robin Kelly, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much, Peter.
The killing of 18-year-old Michael Brown by Ferguson, Missouri police officer Darren Wilson in August 2014 and the resulting protests would probably have received some media coverage, but the amount and the tenor of that coverage was decidedly shaped by the intervention of black social media, who, along with other activists, made Brown's killing a watershed moment in the fight for racial justice. We talked about the role of media at the time with Malkia Cyril, executive director of the Center for Media Justice.
Yes, I mean, the lingo Black Twitter isn't about the company at all. It's about the hundreds of Black blogs, independent Black blogs and Black bloggers websites, individual pundits that use the social media platform to microblog and talk about what they see as the primary issues affecting Black communities. And one of the reasons that it's so important is because these journalists, Black journalists, have been slowly excluded and marginalized in mainstream media. The numbers of Black journalists able to work in mainstream media has decreased over the last 10 years significantly. And what we find is that both these journalists and the community journalists that we're talking about on Twitter have found social media to be an outlet, to be a way to share their work in a way that wasn't able to happen on CNN, MSNBC, or any of the other cable news outlets, because cable is owned by mega corporations and doesn't allow for the kind of independent voice that a more social platform on the internet allows for. So Black Twitter, reminiscent of and reflecting the Black blog, an independent Black voice, that is what really brought the story of Ferguson to the majority of Black audiences.
Well, on the one hand, you want to say it's not the technology that's key. I mean, media and other powers could have tried to listen to Black people if they were writing on parchment, you know. But at the same time, the technology and the kind of communication that it makes possible is something different, isn't it?
Absolutely. The decentralized nature of the internet allows for a level of democratized voice that we've never seen. I mean, the internet as a platform, as a vehicle for voice in Black communities, has become one of the most powerful ways to bypass the exclusionary and discriminatory mainstream media. And because of that, because of its decentralized and democratized nature, Black people are very conscious of the need to fight to maintain their online and digital voice.
Well, let's talk about that fight. I mean, we know that for corporate media, this story is gonna go away. Every racist act in corporate media is an anecdote. We're told that things raise questions when they might more appropriately be said to answer them. We hear, gosh, this doesn't look like America, when it looks exactly like America. And Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote recently about the politics of changing the subject. You know, let's talk about Black folks killing each other. All of this is why, even when decent coverage happens, it feels like reinventing the wheel, and it points up the need for a sustained space to have a conversation that doesn't just serve as corrective of that dominant narrative and stop there, but moves forward. So what is the state of play on the fight to have the internet be that sort of space?
Well, right now, you know, as the people of Ferguson are on the front lines demanding justice for yet another murder of a young Black man unarmed, Black people are also on the front lines to maintain the right to speak online about the rampant police brutality in our communities. And one of the front lines that Black people are fighting on is the fight for the open internet. Black communities across this country are saying loud and clear that they want to keep the internet open. We understand that the only way that the court in Verizon versus the FCC said very clearly, the only way the Federal Communications Commission can enforce non-discrimination rules online is to reclassify broadband as a Title II common carrier service. Now, let me explain that for a minute, because people say, well, what is Title II? Title II simply means that the internet should be treated as a public utility. It should be regulated like a public utility. Some organizations are concerned that if we regulate the internet as a public utility, it'll kill innovation. But what Black communities know very well is that it's two things. One, public utilities, when they are truly public, are secure and reliable. So that's number one. We want a reliable platform for independent voices, and making it, treating it like a utility, regulating it as such, makes it a civil right that we can access publicly. So that's number one. Number two, some organizations and individuals have been concerned that if we if we treat the internet like a public utility, that a future commission, FCC commission, a future Congress will come along and take that away. And to that, I think black communities are very clear. When we fought against segregation in education, we did not accept anything less than the ruling in Brown versus Board of Education. There were rulings prior to that. There were court cases for more than a decade prior to that victory. We didn't accept any piecemeal, half-baked legislation. We only took what was morally right and just. And that was an end to segregation in education. And that's what we're talking about right now. Ultimately, reclassifying broadband would ensure no segregation online, that all voices were able to join the public conversation, and that black voices in particular were able to be raised around issues like police brutality, like the incident in Ferguson. And that's what we're fighting for.
Let me just ask you finally, used to be when you told someone you were working on media policy, they would come back with, oh, well, I do real activism. You know, I'm in the street and media is somehow an ancillary issue. That day's over, isn't it? I mean, not everyone can work on every issue, but the separation of media policy issues from other issues that we care about is not a meaningful separation.
Well, it was never a meaningful separation, and civil rights activists in the 1960s knew that very well when they took a television news station, WLBT, to task for their failure to cover segregation in the South. And in fact, that case, the case of WLBT, became the defining case that allowed for public comment in media policy processes. So civil rights organizations have long been an advocate for media as a civil rights issue. It's only as media and telecommunications has become so lucrative, it's only as telecommunications companies have used the buyout of our communities as a public relations strategy that these issues have become technocratic, wonky, and separate from the core issues of social justice. What we know, what Ferguson shows us, what it showed me, is that, in fact, there is no path to victory, to change, without the visibility and representation that media provides. And that media, as long as that media is owned, operated, and controlled by the largest internet service providers, the largest cable companies, the largest private families, the black voice is in jeopardy. And if the black voice is in jeopardy, the black freedom is in jeopardy. And that's what we're fighting for. We're not fighting for some back-end technocratic issue. We're fighting for the cause of black freedom. We're fighting for the same cause that all the black newspapers right after slavery were fighting for. We're fighting for an end to any kind of past system, to any kind of system that violates or limits our voice. And that is what we're talking about here today. It's not about media policy. It's about real justice.
We've been speaking with Malkia Cyril from the Center for Media Justice, online at centerformediajustice.org. Her recent article, Thank You Black Internet for Bringing the Hashtag Ferguson to Me, appeared in the Huffington Post, among other outlets. Thank you so much, Malkia Cyril, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
Black Lives Matter addresses more than police violence, which of course happens in a societal context. There's also a demand to recognize other policies and practices that oppress and marginalize black Americans. As media move to Baltimore in the wake of Freddie Gray's April 2015 death after arrest, we talked about other aspects of that societal context with the Economic Policy Institute's Richard Rothstein.
Well, we have a myth in this country that we have what the lawyers call de facto segregation, that we created these neighborhoods like the inner city of Baltimore that are almost all black, that are poor, that are segregated from mainstream society by accident, either because black people were too poor to move to the suburbs or because there was private prejudice or because there was white flight of people who didn't want to live near blacks. And although some of that is true, the bigger cause, the most important cause of segregation is public policy that was deliberately intended for the first two-thirds of the 20th century to separate black and white families. And segregation was a government policy. It was racially conscious. It was not the unintended consequence of benign policies. It was designed by federal, state, and local governments to segregate our communities. And this was true in every metropolitan area in the country. Now, in Baltimore, in the early 20th century, Baltimore actually passed an ordinance defining which blocks blacks could live on and which blocks whites could live on. When that kind of ordinance was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1917, the mayor of Baltimore set up a committee on segregation to make sure that even without the ordinance still being in effect, that housing inspectors, that health inspectors would enforce segregation. And if any family in a white neighborhood were to sell to a black family, the housing and health inspectors would make sure that the black family could no longer live there. And this kind of thing went on at local level for many years. Then the federal government played a major role in explicitly segregating neighborhoods in Baltimore and throughout the country. The first civilian public housing program began in the New Deal under the Public Works Administration. It was a New Deal program to create housing for civilian population. And it was segregated. The director of the Public Works Administration in the Franklin Roosevelt administration established what he called a neighborhood composition rule, which was that public housing could only be established for people of the race in the neighborhood where the public housing was established. In fact, many of the public housing projects were established in integrated neighborhoods. They tore down integrated neighborhoods and created segregated neighborhoods in their place. That's one of the things that happened in St. Louis, for example, that led to the kind of situation we have in Ferguson. That continued. Public housing continued to be segregated throughout the 20th century up until the mid-1950s. In 1949, President Truman proposed a massive expansion of public housing programs in this country. At the time, there was still a civilian housing shortage, so public housing was for whites, not just for blacks. Mm-hmm. And in order to try to defeat his public housing proposal, Republicans in Congress put forward what they called a poison pill amendment. That was an amendment that would require public housing to be integrated. Knowing that if the amendment passed, Southern Democrats would then no longer vote for public housing and the entire public housing program would be defeated. So liberal Democrats in the Senate and the House, led by people like Hubert Humphrey, campaigned against the integration amendment, because they argued that if the public housing was integrated, there would be no public housing at all. And this was true throughout the country. This was not just for the South. And so segregated public housing was created throughout the country. The biggest federal policy, probably, was the policy of the Federal Housing Administration, which financed, starting in the early 1940s, builders of subdivisions, mass production builders of places like you're familiar with in Levittown, New York, or Daly City in California, and subdivisions everywhere in between. They financed builders to create subdivisions of single-family homes in the suburbs on condition that they be sold to whites only. That was an explicit condition of the Federal Housing Administration financing of bank loans to developers. So while whites and blacks were of similar incomes, returning war veterans, for example, working-class families, could have afforded to buy into the suburbs, only whites were permitted to do so. Blacks were consigned not only to urban ghettos, but to segregated public housing in urban ghettos. And those are the kinds of policies that resulted in what we see in Baltimore today, what we saw in St. Louis, and what we've seen around the country for the last 50 years. One more thing. In 1970, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development of the Nixon administration was a fellow named George Romney, the father of the recent presidential candidate. George Romney understood everything that I've just described to you, as did most people at that time. We've forgotten this history. George Romney said that the federal government had created a white noose around inner-city ghettos, and it was the job of the federal government now to untie that noose. And George Romney began a program which he called Open Communities, in which he denied federal funds to suburbs that refused to desegregate. And one of the first test cases he made of this policy of denying federal funds for sewers and parkland and water projects was to Baltimore County. And he told Baltimore County that it was not going to get any more federal funds for any urban projects unless it repealed its exclusionary zoning ordinance, that is, ordinance that prohibited the construction of multifamily dwellings in the suburbs, unless it accepted public housing with African Americans, and unless it accepted subsidized low-income housing. Baltimore County was one of the first places that he tried to do that. Mm-hmm. Eventually, George Romney was reined in by the Nixon administration because there was a white backlash to his desegregation policies, and Romney himself was eventually forced out as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and we've had nothing as aggressive in way of desegregation since. So this history is once well known. It was once widely accepted and understood that segregation was not an accident, but it was a purposeful creation of state, federal, and local government. And we've now forgotten that we think that it happened by accident. And when we think it happened by accident, we then think there's nothing we can do about it. Whereas if we understood that this was the product of government policy, we would understand that there are government policies that could reverse it.
And maybe it should go without saying, but of course, the connection between housing ownership and the accumulation of wealth is absolutely critical. So these policies explain even more than where people live.
Well, that's correct. I mean, when you concentrate the low-income population in an area, of course, they become more low-income because they don't have access to jobs. And as you probably know, in the 1950s, jobs began to move from urban areas out to suburbs because African Americans were concentrated in a noose, as George Romney said, in central cities. They had no access to the jobs that were being created, so the community became poorer than it was before.
We've been speaking with Richard Rothstein of the Economic Policy Institute. You can find his work on their site. It's epi.org. Richard Rothstein, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. For more information, check out FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Reactions to the Paris Climate Agreement are all over the map. Unexpectedly, our correspondent Paul Beckwith wonders if it isn't a tipping point in human affairs. After extreme weather events all over the planet, they keep happening. Lindsay Allen from RAN isn't so sure. Before we talk with them, I want you to hear an extraordinary teleconference hosted by former Earthbeat radio host Daphne Wysham. We hear how West Coast cities are leading us out of the fossil age, even as they struggle with constant demand for more pipelines, more ports. Oh, and by the way, one California mayor reports thousands are living under a toxic cloud, while fracking has poisoned the water system used for one quarter of North America's produce. Mmm, good food. I'm Alex Smith, with all that and more this week on Radio EcoShock. Just when things look bleak for the climate, we discover city mayors are way ahead of national leaders. Daphne Wysham leads this story. She's the former host of the syndicated radio program Earthbeat and now director of climate and energy program at the Center for Sustainable Economy. From Portland, Oregon, Daphne, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
In a few minutes, we're going to hear from some West Coast progressive cities on a conference call you did. But first, tell us about the movement against any new infrastructure for fossil fuels.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've found since moving back out to the Pacific Northwest is that there's a very strong grassroots movement against some 27 fossil fuel export proposals that are on the books right now all across the Pacific Northwest that represent, by some studies, five times the carbon content of the Keystone XL pipeline annually. And so there's this rich grassroots resistance to all of these proposals. However, it's very time-consuming and exhausting because in some cases, as soon as you've defeated one proposal, another one comes down the pike. And in some cases, in the same towns and the same cities, over and over again, we have to rally the troops and get them out there to testify and so on. And one thing that we decided that we really needed in place was a more, not a defensive, an offensive posture. And so when Portland got a proposal for a propane export terminal, we rallied again. We got hundreds of people turning out at the hearing saying, no, we don't want this propane export terminal to be bringing mile-long trains down from Alberta filled with highly explosive propane to export to China. We don't want this in our town. And we succeeded in getting our mayor to turn around. And we decided after we got our mayor to reverse his initial support for this that we really wanted to see once and for all no new fossil fuel infrastructure in the city of Portland. After all, it's one of the greenest cities in the country. It's the first to put in place the Climate Action Plan, the first to not only meet but exceed the Kyoto Protocol targets, got the highest bike ridership in the country. On and on. It just was a bad idea for Portland to have to be facing any new fossil fuel infrastructure projects. So again, we pushed our mayor and pushed the city council. And on November 12th, we got in place the strongest fossil fuel infrastructure policy that we know of in the country. Perhaps only Vancouver, BC is close to ours. And they're in Canada, obviously. But shortly thereafter, I decided, you know, if it's good for Portland, it should be good for all these other cities. So after this passed, we developed a website, nonewffi.org, as in no new fossil fuel infrastructure. I managed to get endorsements from groups all over the country, including Indigenous Environmental Network, Winona Duke of Honor the Earth, Bill McKibben, and others. And then we started pushing for mayors to endorse Mayor Hale's resolution and commit to doing similar, putting in place similar restrictions on fossil fuel infrastructure in their jurisdiction. And I was stunned at how quickly we managed to get, last count, I think there were 11 mayors and over 30 elected officials on the West Coast in a matter of days signed on to endorse this resolution. So now comes the tough work of making this binding law, which we will be doing over the coming year, and then taking the lessons that we learned from that practice to begin to share lessons learned with other cities up and down the West Coast and ideally all over North America.
Is there more news you want to share following your teleconference with civic leaders?
The biggest surprise to me was the mayor of Richmond, California, which is home to Chevron, the Chevron refinery that has sickened and killed, actually, I think, several of my family members who used to work in the region died of cancer as a result of that refinery. Quite a few people in the community, they have a very high cancer rate. And there's been a lot of great organizing in Richmond. And so it's very exciting that we now have the mayor of Richmond, California, on board this resolution pledging no new fossil fuel infrastructure and a just transition for the workers there.
Daphne, we need to know the websites where listeners can find out more about stopping the expansion of fossil fuels and finding better energy alternatives.
Yes, and that's another thing it's so exciting. You can listen to the audio from our press conference, and one of the people at our press conference was a mayor from Southern California who has put in place the first, what he calls a net zero carbon city in the country, where they're developing renewable, so much solar power that they're actually exporting it. He also happens to be the lead plaintiff in a class action lawsuit taking on this gigantic methane leak that's happening right now in Southern California that represents 25% of all of California's methane emissions. So he's a very powerful speaker, and you can listen to him and Winona and Bill McKibben and others at nonewffi.org. We need your support. We'd love to get people endorsing our petition, organizations, businesses, and others. We need everybody on board this movement.
Good. And what's the website for the Center for Sustainable Economy?
It's just sustainable-economy.org, but you can also find it. We link to it at nonewffi.org.
We'll get that and scene.org, all of those links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Daphne, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Radio EcoShock.
Let's hear some local leaders on this conference call against more fossil fuel infrastructure. Leave it in the ground. We begin with Vancouver, Canada, going fossil free. We'll hear from Winona LaDuke on her people's pipeline battle. And get ready for some incredible news about poisoned waters in California, where one quarter of America's produce comes from, and better news, the first net zero city in the world. Here's Daphne Wisham introducing Andrea Reimer.
Andrea Reimer was appointed as Vancouver, BC's first permanent deputy mayor after serving 6 years as chair of the Standing Committee on Planning, Transportation, and the Environment. She's been the council lead on the greenest city action plan since its inception in 2009, and in 2015 spearheaded the city's efforts to be the first major city in the Americas to commit to 100% renewable energy. Andrea Reimer, welcome to our conference call.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here today on behalf of our mayor, Gregor Robertson. So I was going to speak just a bit to some of the work that Vancouver's been doing. I know that we don't share the same national government, but we definitely share the same coastline and a lot of the same challenges that Portland does, the same geography, essentially, a lot of the same geoclimatic, and very similar cultures and histories that have informed the work that we're doing today. So it's exciting to be aligned with them on this initiative. So Vancouver did pass the first renewable energy strategy of any major city in the Americas back in November 2015, so just about a month ago. It commits the city of Vancouver to 100% renewable energy for electricity, heating, cooling, and transportation. So all fossil fuel burning would be banned as a result of replacement by renewable energy. So that renewable energy strategy builds on a pretty significant body of work we'd already been undertaking through our Greenest City Action Plan. So Greenest City was a commitment that we made in 2009 when we were first elected to be the greenest city in the world by the year 2020. At the time, we didn't even show up on the rankings. They don't rank every city in the world, so all we know was we were lower than the last ranked city, which was about number 500. Now, just last year, we were awarded fourth greenest city on Earth, so that's a pretty significant movement, and it's been a huge effort for us, not just on climate, but on water, on waste, on food, on green jobs, and just transition strategy. So that plan, when it was established, also set long-term targets that looked out to 2050, and one of those was an end to fossil fuels, and that's given us the mandate since 2009 to vigorously oppose any new fossil fuel infrastructure that is proposed to be in the city of Vancouver, although generally they tend to take the form of things coming through the city of Vancouver seeking the ocean to go out somewhere in the world. Sort of an irony in Canada that you had this massive tar sands up in Alberta, and the last thing it would have to pass through to get out to the ocean and to market is through the city of Vancouver, which has this green aspiration. So we've been fighting the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which is a proposal to increase tar sand export, tar sand bitumen exports through the West Coast ports by a sevenfold increase. In 2012, out of frustration with having to every single time a new proposal came forward, pass a motion, we passed an omnibus that we would oppose all new fossil fuel infrastructure. In 2013, we banned coal terminals, so it's taken completely out of our zoning and development bylaw. It's impossible to build one in the city of Vancouver. And then in 2015, you know, when you spend a lot of time fighting against things, it builds a lot of support to fight for something. And that's where the renewable energy strategy came in, that we really felt that rather than having to keep going talking about what we didn't want in the city, we really needed to get people mobilized, especially in the COP21 year, behind the vision of the future that they imagined was possible, what Bill was talking about. So we passed that in early 2015. Our staff have been working with the community and experts and people around the world to build the strategy, which was formally adopted in November. It's bold and ambitious, but completely doable. It is one of the first motions I've ever passed at council where I thought, you know, maybe this is actually impossible. It turns out it's not at all. It's about saying, yes, this is where we're going, and then putting all of our human innovation and talent into figuring out how we are going to get there. When we passed our original motion at the beginning of the year, we were one of less than a dozen cities in the world that had passed policy to that effect. Now we are one of hundreds of cities, and we expect that that growth will continue exponentially because none of us can do this alone. So exciting times to be partnering with other cities on this. Really excited to hear what the other cities on the call are doing.
Thank you, Andrea. I wanted to announce a very exciting new endorser of our ban on new fossil fuel infrastructure, which is the mayor of Richmond, California, home of the enormous Chevron oil refinery. Mayor Tom Butt signed on from Paris, France, just last night. We also got the endorsement of Mayor Kitty Piercy of Eugene. So the long list of endorsers is up on our website, which is nonewffi.org. You can sign on there and also see all of the elected officials that have signed on. Next up is Mayor Rex Harris. He is the mayor of Lancaster, California, and he's an attorney representing the thousands of families in Porter Ranch, California, who are being forced to live under a cloud of methane, benzene, and hydrosulfide gases as a result of an injection well blowout that is being called the BP of the West Coast. Some environmental groups claim that this one leak represents 25% of California's methane emissions annually, and it still remains uncapped. As mayor of Lancaster, California, he enacted the first ordinance requiring solar panels on all new construction. Lancaster will be the first net zero city in the world. Currently, all city operated buildings in school are powered by solar. Thanks for joining us, Mayor Parrott.
Okay. First, let me talk to you about the city of Lancaster, and then I'll tell you a little bit about what's going on in Porter Ranch. About 8 years ago, the city of Lancaster made the decision to become the first net zero city in the country, if not the world. We will reach that goal within the next 8 months. What that means is we will be producing more energy from the sun than we use in the entire city. We were the first city to pass an ordinance that requires solar panels on every house. And what was most interesting about that is there was almost no pushback from it, and it was embraced by all of the citizens from what we can tell. And as a result of it, we're now, the builders in this city are now building net zero houses using batteries from BYD, which is a company in China. The thing we will be announcing in the next few months is a 500 megawatt storage facility that BYD from China will be building in our city. What's significant about that is that means there really isn't much need for more infrastructure. We now have the ability to store the alternative energy, which has always been the problem as to replacing fossil fuels with alternative energy, and it looks like we've conquered that now. The problem is obviously this requires a huge shift in people's business models that are going to be resisted and are being resisted. The necessity of dealing with the infrastructure that the fossil fuel industry is forcing upon us is becoming more and more apparent in California. Before the Porter Ranch blowout of the injection wells, what we discovered is that the water supply in the San Joaquin Valley that feeds 25% of our nation's food supply, grown food supply, comes from the San Joaquin Valley. And the aquifers appear to be poisoned. The cherry trees started to die. Now the almond trees are dying. And the testing shows that we're getting, in some cases, benzene levels of 1,000 times what's acceptable. All kinds of hydrocarbon poisons are in there. And that's because the oil industry has been injecting directly into the drinking water of California. The thing we should start recognizing is this industry has no responsibility whatsoever. They have captive agencies regulating them, and as a result, the impact they're having on the climate, the country, and the citizens is beyond comprehension. The Porter Ranch situation is an example of that. They used a 50-year-old well. It was drilled in 1954. To pump oil, and they use that as an injection well to store natural gas under high pressures. The inevitable happened, it blew, and now we have thousands of families living under this cloud with very little we can do about it. We're trying to relocate them. The gas company is resisting. This is Sempra Energies that's responsible for this. And we're going to have more and more of these situations develop as they take more and more risks in finding energy. I guess that pretty well sums it up.
That was Rex Paris, mayor of Lancaster, California, the first net zero city, on a conference call with Daphne Wisham against new fossil fuel infrastructure.
Winona LaDuke is a former vice presidential candidate and executive director of Honor the Earth. I'm going to turn it over to you now, Winona.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to call in. I'm from northern Minnesota, the White Earth Reservation, and we're in a situation where we are facing three big new oil pipelines that they propose to put across our wild rice beds. Those pipelines will be carrying fracked oil from the Bakken and tar sands oil. You know, we are people that live this whole world. This is our whole world up here, and these pipelines are not necessary. Oil demand has diminished, and in the face of the stranded assets and liabilities, they will be for future generations. We're saying no new fossil fuel pipelines in the north. We're saying no new fossil fuel pipelines. And, you know, to be honest, probably like everyone else in this conference call, I'm not opposed to infrastructure. We're a country that has a D plus in infrastructure. We have crumbling bridges. We have gas mains that explode. We don't have, many of our reservations don't even have basic infrastructure. So I'm all for infrastructure. But what we'd like is infrastructure which is for people, not for oil companies, and not a liability to all of us. So we're looking at the Enbridge pipelines, not the TransCanada. These are the Enbridge lines, and their goal is to get to Superior, the furthest inland port. And the people that are in between them are all the Ojibwe reservations.
This is Andrea Reimer from Vancouver.
Yeah.
Can I just add something to the earlier point?
Sure.
I mean, there's obviously a very compelling environmental case to stop burning fossil fuels, very compelling social case that Winona laid out. There's, I would argue, a moral case by virtue of the fact that someone gave us the future that is today. We have a responsibility to give a future to the next generation. But there's also an extremely compelling economic case to it. So if I was Mobil and I know that there's no future for fossil fuels on the planet, there's global treaty being signed that will continue to constrain and limit the burning of those fossil fuels. If there's no future for the thing your economy depends on, there's no future for your economy. So just at a straight economic level, I would be looking at that and thinking about what is the next thing we are going to be doing as a city. Vancouver, with the Greenest City Action Plan, our economy has grown by leaps and bounds, almost too fast, actually, to be socially sustainable. We will be by far the fastest growing economy in Canada over this next year because of the over-reliance of fossil fuels in other parts of the country. And even at that, continue to meet and exceed the goals that we've set on green. So I think if you're charged with thinking about the future of your community, not just from a weather or climate standpoint, but from how the economy is going to work, you should be thinking about that transition right now.
This is Rex again from Lancaster. Okay, on a smaller scale, we could echo exactly what Vancouver is saying. We thought this was going to be an economic detriment to us, and we found just the opposite. Our people are paying less electricity charges. We're bringing in more industry that's clean industry. It's been nothing but pluses. And I think, I don't know what Vancouver expected, but we were expecting the opposite, and we're just pleasantly surprised.
There you go. National leaders are way behind the cities. Isn't that partly because most people know the weather and the climate aren't right? And local elections are harder for big corporations to buy? My thanks to Daphne Wysham of the Center for Sustainable Economy. Be sure and check out and support the movement to stop more fossil fuel pipelines, ports, and development at the website nonewffi.org. Find a link to the full audio of this teleconference with more guests at nonewffi.org and in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Mainstream media tells you the Paris Climate Summit was a deal to save the ages. For a different take, we've reached regular Radio EcoShock contributor Paul Beckwith. He's the scientist studying and teaching climate science in Canada at the University of Ottawa. Paul was just in Paris, in the streets and in meeting halls, but now he's in Norway. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Alex.
Well, later I'm going to ask you why Norway, but my big question for now is, what are your impressions and takeaways from the COP21 climate talks in Paris, December 2015?
I'm very encouraged with what I saw in Paris. It doesn't go far enough, we know that, but I think it really does get the ball rolling, something which the previous 20 COP did not do. And getting the ball rolling in Paris, you know, being a major, you know, European city, there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes with diplomats, with negotiators, with policymakers in different countries. There seems to be a different atmosphere. There was some sense of the importance and the urgency. And I think it's because people's wallets all over the planet are starting to be affected a lot by climate change. It's becoming very important for economies and countries financially to take climate change seriously. You know, I don't think that the politicians and policymakers, most of them, are quite to speed on, you know, Arctic sea ice decline and the risk of methane coming up. But they are tying the extreme weather events that we're seeing around the world to climate change. So they're recognizing that, hey, we've only had a degree of warming in the planet and we're already getting these severe events. And you have people like in the Stern Report saying that a certain percentage of global GDP will be required to fight climate change. And the longer we leave it, the worse it becomes. And him saying that he thinks he underestimated the rate at which climate change was occurring and things like that. I was very encouraged by all of this.
But James Hansen was not. He says this voluntary approach has never worked before, so why would it work now? I just wonder, it took us, Paul, about 25 years to take climate change seriously, and I don't see tools built into this agreement to actually do very much. Am I wrong on that?
Well, James Hansen would be unhappy with anything less than a global fee on carbon, a fee and dividend approach to carbon on a global basis. So if the countries agreed, okay, we'll put a fee on carbon of, say, you know, start off at $10 or $20, $30 a ton, and increase it every few years after reevaluation, and have a dividend being returned back to the people, which is what the group Citizens Climate Lobby, you know, many people in the public have joined this group, and this is what they've been pushing. And I think most economists that actually study the problem recognize that's the best thing to do. So we haven't seen that yet. But the ball has started to roll. Like, people in finance are talking about climate change being a serious issue. If listeners haven't seen the speech a couple of days before the end of COP by John Kerry talking about how the military is recognizing the risks and climate change is the most important, the most severe issue that the world has to face. And, you have, of course, the Pope saying the same thing. You have other people saying the same thing, scientists saying the same thing. So I think probably my expectations of what could happen in Paris are a lot lower than Hansen's. Like I say, I think Hansen is seeing black and white, you know, no carbon fee and dividend, therefore failure of the conference. What I'm seeing is the global ball is starting to roll down the hill, and it will only pick up speed. Like, to give you an idea, the EU preparation for the Paris conference, it involved 90,000 diplomats in numerous countries in the EU and also outside the EU. So there's tremendous diplomatic momentum that will occur after Paris. I mean, Paris is not the be-all and end-all. It just got the talks going, and it got some sort of agreement. And it's like, we may look back. You never know when there's a tipping point, when it happens, generally. It's only looking in the rearview mirror that you see that. And so what's happening coming up this year is climate change is definitely on the agenda for all 2016 multilateral events, because we have the World Economic Forum coming up in 2016. We have a G7 meeting in 2016. We have a G20 meeting, and there's follow-up meetings to Paris, and the UN is holding numerous meetings, and there's energy strategy and diplomacy and bilateral partnerships with China, Latin America, and the US. There's all these things going on, and all of these things will now go on given that Paris has happened and that agreements have started. So I think that we'll see the ball rolling faster and faster, especially if we are undergoing abrupt climate change, which I've been saying that we have for quite a while. Then I think we'll start seeing these abrupt changes in human response. I've talked about the human tipping point. One cannot say that it's occurred yet, but I think maybe 3, 4, 5 years down the road, we'll be able to say that it did occur, if it does in fact occur. So, you know, Paris is only the beginning. It's not the end, but we're certainly in a much better position globally on policy and so on than we were 3 weeks ago, say, before the Paris meeting, I would argue.
So is this agreement giant and complex, or are there layers in it that we should understand? Is there anything you'd like to talk about what was actually agreed on?
The Conference of Parties, it involves all the parties of the world, and the parties are the different countries. So there were 196 or something. There were, you know, maybe 4 or 5 or something like that, that weren't involved, you know, small countries or for whatever reason. But they had these intended nationally determined contributions. So this is what they say they're trying to achieve. But see, I think what happens is, I mean, what I understand is, you know, if a country opts out of what they're saying they can do, if they're not making an honest effort to try it, then I think that country will be hurt. Like, their global standing will be hurt. They'll kind of be ridiculed by the other countries. Their economies will suffer. They're developing countries, for example. There's tremendous money that will be going into climate finance before 2020. Like, there's, I saw the number 100 billion, and then, in Kerry's speech, he was talking about 80 billion from the U.S. or something, and he said that was going to be doubled. I mean, look, how many other COPs have had the Mark Carneys of the world debating with Michael Bloomberg's of the world about climate and investment, and with Tom Steyer sitting in the front row, and, you know, and Bill Gates and multi-billionaires, Musk and other people, you know, attending the conference, taking a big role, attending the sessions on investment and climate change, you know, each going up and saying things. Watch the facial expressions, watch what the reactions, you know, how people are speaking, like Kerry and Gates and Musk and others, when they're up. And if you can read people, it seems that these people are really starting to get concerned about the rapid changes that are happening, because the changes that we're observing in the climate system are invariably happening much faster, with much more serious implications than the IPCC documents would tend to show. I don't know for sure. I mean, I haven't been to all of the COPs. I mean, I went to Lima last year, and Paris is my second one. And judging from the meetings that were occurring in Paris, it was like night and day compared to Lima. And also, you know, Lima being in Peru, sure. I mean, if we had exactly the same, this year it wasn't in Paris. It was in, say, I mean, the next year it's in Morocco. If it was in, you know, a different country, but it's in the heart of Europe. The city got on board. The whole city of Paris got on board. You know, you ride on their buses, which are super green. They have all these green initiatives. There were over 100 mayors from major cities across the world that were at Paris. There were side events on climate change affecting the global food supply. There were side events on climate change and health. And it was packed with medical doctors from top medical institutions and countries around the world talking about how it's very underestimated the impacts of climate change on humans, not just on diseases and things, but also on mental stability, mental health, you know, well-being, things like that. There was a separate session on climate change in the aviation industry. And there's a whole group that's been around for a while, you know, just looking at how to reduce emissions in aviation. And, you know, they say things like 20 years ago when a flight would use so much carbon and we're using half as much now 20 years later. And one of the things is bigger planes, you know, carrying more people, you know, which is a more efficient way to do it. Same thing with the shipping industry. So the shipping industry, you know, a lot of the ships are dirty, polluting. And you can see the trails from the ships for hours and hours or days after the ship's gone by. You know, these two industries were left out. I mean, those emissions weren't associated with any country before, but now they're being incorporated. So it seems that people are getting a lot more serious about dealing with the issue. And I think there's only one reason for that. And that is because we're undergoing abrupt climate change and the climate system is going to hell. And we're seeing all of the, you know, threats to food supply. We're seeing droughts places. We're seeing more and more cities succumbing to the climate casino, the negative aspects of the climate casino, like being flooded out or something. There's an enormous economic impact on infrastructure, and it's happening now. It's not happening 20 years or 50 years or 100 years in the future. It's not happening with our grandkids. It's happening right now.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith about the COP21 climate summit in Paris. Paul, you mentioned Bill Gates, and I know you, as a member of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, feel that we should take some technological action to save what's left of the ice system in the Arctic. How did you take Bill Gates' announcement, and how does that work into what you may be up to in Norway?
There's no question. The COP is all about reducing emissions, so it's how quickly do we need to do it. The idea is stay below the target of 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees. Although I think that is the wrong target. I think the target should be more, okay, we've had 1 degree already and we have a big temperature imbalance between the equator and the Arctic, and that's throwing off the jet streams and it's throwing off the ocean current and it's causing the extreme weather events. So those things need to be considered more, and is there a way to correct that imbalance? So I was talking about a three-legged bar stool, and zeroing emissions, if we want to stay below 2, we need, without doing anything else in terms of CDR, carbon dioxide removal, or solar radiation management, if we want to stay under 2 degrees, we have to zero emissions by 2050. That was kind of the conclusion. If we want to stay below 1.5 degrees, we have to zero emissions by 2030. But, you know, is that physically possible to do? Probably not, in which case we have to aim at zeroing emissions as much as possible, but that's only one leg of the stool. You need three legs on a bar stool for stability. So the second leg is CDR, carbon dioxide removal. 400 ppm is too high. We're threatening the food chain and the ocean. The ocean acidification is going to take out phytoplankton, which will mess up the entire food chain. And we threaten, mass extinction in the ocean, which would then go to land if we continue to operate even at the level that we're at. So 350 now is all founded on the premise of getting down to 350. James Hansen says we need to get down to 350. When I talked to James Hansen and Jason Box and other people and said, well, look, okay, we zero emissions, we're not going down to 350. We need carbon dioxide removal. And James Hansen came back and said, well, he thinks that the natural sinks on the Earth would be large enough to actually remove CO2 from the atmosphere if we zeroed emissions. I mean, I happen not to agree with that. And Jason Box was also saying similar things. So these people, they just don't want to say that word, CDR. They don't want to say that dreaded geoengineering word. But that's the second leg of the stool. And the third leg is the solar radiation management, because we risk losing sea ice by 2020. If we lose sea ice by 2020 and the snow covers also in the spring is also dropping at an even faster rate than the sea ice, and they're both trending down almost exponentially to zero. And if you just see a trend based on 30 years of data down to zero in 4 or 5 more years, I mean, if there's a turnaround, great. If there's not, we lose sea ice. And if we lose sea ice, then, you know, it would be for maybe a week or two the first year, and then it would extend to several months within a few years, and it would extend to year-round. Then we have huge increases in Greenland ice melt. We have a complete change in the Arctic ecosystem. We have methane emissions coming up from the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf in the Kara Sea, and there was a recent paper showing mounds. These pingo, these methane craters in Siberia have an analogous form under the ocean, and what we're seeing is big mounds appearing in the Kara Sea, these massive mounds, which are probably pressure from the methane hydrate thawing underneath, pushing them up. So we're playing with fire here. So this is what AMEG has been saying at least 4 years. So we need to try to cool the Arctic to ensure that the carbon stays in place. And we know how to do this. And we're looking at a non-intrusive ways like marine cloud brightening, but that takes time to develop. We're looking at simple, quick and dirty fixes, which is taking some of the sulfur from a power plant, which spews sulfur into the lower atmosphere, and putting that sulfur into the upper atmosphere over the Arctic in the summer to cool the region, to ensure that we don't lose sea ice and snow cover and that the methane stays in place. So the stool, I'm arguing that all these aspects of the stool are required, no matter how unpalatable people think this may be. Because I would argue you cannot be against CDR or against SRM. If you're going to be against those, you need to convince people that if we do nothing, that we're not going to get tremendous increases in extreme weather events, that we're not, that the sea ice is going to stay, and we have time to do all of these other things. Because you can't just be against something if you don't talk about, you need to talk about the pros and cons. So if we don't do some of these things I'm saying we need to do, then we're going to not enjoy the planet that we end up having.
Paul Beckwith, tell us what you're up to in Norway.
Okay, so in Norway, I'm co-founding a startup company. The name is Gaia Engineering, and we've been working for quite a while. Up to now, I haven't met the people that I'm co-founding this with, apart from over social media, over Skype calls, etc. But we have some ideas that we think we can use to transition the skills of people in Norway. There's 300,000 people in Norway directly in the oil industry. The government has taken a big chunk of oil revenue and has built up the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is $1 trillion. It's interesting because Canada has taken all the flack for the oil sands and tar sands. Everybody in the world knows about the dirty oil from Canada. And Norway, you know, they're getting its conventional oil from their rigs off sea, and they have had a much bigger impact probably than the tar sands because they're pulling way more oil out. But because Norway is doing a lot of other things that are green and a lot of European countries are on it with, they're really up to speed with energy efficiency and things like that. They have been for years because fuel prices have been much higher in Europe. But this oil industry, they recognize that it is not going to last forever. And with, you know, they recognize carbon taxes are coming. They have to transition out. So we want to use that skill set in order to do some CDR, develop some CDR methods and some SRM methods to make a bigger impact and get the ball rolling to, you know, reduce emissions faster than they would be reduced just by, you know, we flashing them is fine. We also need to reduce them. So we're looking at projects that will do that. I did a presentation a few nights ago, and it was recorded, but the live feed was no good because the Wi-Fi was no good. But we recorded 2 hours. I was introduced by a Green Party member. Green Party is really big in Norway. And then I talked for about 45 minutes, and then the team for Gaia Engineering was introduced, and then there was question and answers from the crowd. So we had a two-hour session, and we will be releasing that recording along with the PowerPoint slides that I gave at that presentation. We'll be releasing that on the Gaia Engineering website and Twitter feeds and stuff like that very, very soon. And then that will give people a much better idea of some of the things that I'm involved with in Norway.
Well, great. I think it is the future that some of the money accumulated by the oil industry will have to be used to transition the climate away from their own product, but also that will put the oil companies in a new business and a cleaner business, we hope. That's my opinion. So Paul Beckwith, he's a Canadian climate scientist and super communicator. You can get a lot of what Paul teaches his students at the University of Ottawa from his YouTube videos. Find links to Paul's channel and his busy Facebook page in my show blog at ecoshock.info. or launch from Paul's new webpage at paulbeckwith.net. Thank you again, Paul. Always a pleasure talking with you.
Well, thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Let's get a quick Paris review from Lindsay Allen, the Executive Director of the Rainforest Action Network, or RAND. Lindsay, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's good to be back.
Well, okay. Let's start with the positives in the Paris Agreement. What good was done there?
I mean, it's a big deal anytime you have 195 countries come to consensus on anything. So I think that's one of the big positive takeaways from Paris. If you read the text that's now available that goes through the details of the Paris talks, it does have mention, and I would even say placeholders, for a lot of the critical components of what we wanted to see in the Paris deal. One of the pieces that is really critical to put in perspective is that 195 teams of diplomats did not come together and just sign on to a consensus agreement around dealing with the threat of climate change because they're good people or because their governments are progressive or anything else. We're seeing this action on behalf of governments from all around the world as a result of people-powered campaigns that are being driven by communities that are feeling climate impacts touching down on them every single day. And so that is what we really see as the takeaway message, is that our movement continues to gain momentum, and the role of diplomats in the Paris talks was one example of us starting to show our strength. But it also means that we need to double down and make sure that, A, the commitments that were brought in the Paris Agreement to the Paris talks are really followed through on, and it's critical that we drive far beyond, because as I'm sure you're about to ask, there are a lot of failings of the Paris Agreement.
I do want to get to that, but one other positive I see is that they finally stopped talking about 2 degrees C as something safe and proclaimed by God or something, and mentioned that 1.5 degrees might be more reasonable. What do you think about that?
Yes. So they didn't actually completely stop talking about 2 degrees, but they did really open the door for a 1.5 degree conversation. And as we all know, the difference between stabilizing the catastrophic climate change closer to 1.5 versus 2 is really critical, because it's talking about if we stabilize closer to 1.5, we hope to avoid, based on climate modeling, many of the worst negative feedback loops, which means where we start to get this tipping point, something bad happens, like the Arctic ice sheet starts melting, and then methane, for instance, is released into the atmosphere, and that's a greenhouse gas about 20 times more potent than carbon. So that it is critical to have a 1.5 conversation. It's important to note that 1.5 is not the only marker in the text. So 2 degrees is still in the text. In most of the language, it still refers to 2, although it leaves this qualifier that does say we need to get closer to 1.5. And the reality is the emission reduction commitments that countries brought and that are kind of available as some of the annexes to the agreement don't get us anywhere near 2, let alone 1.5. So that's still a tremendous gap that we're seeing. But you're right that 1.5 is a critical part of the conversation we need to be having.
Okay, so what are some of the other failings of that climate agreement in Paris in December 2015?
So where to start? A couple of key points. One is we know that indigenous rights was not included in binding ways in the agreement. And in general, the agreement does not have as much teeth compared to the sentiment or the placeholder language that's there. So the exclusion of indigenous rights is really critical when we think about, for instance, tropical forests, which is one of the places where we really focus our work. We know that the best way to protect tropical forests is to recognize the solutions that are being driven by indigenous communities. And that's the reason why we really still have intact tropical forests. So indigenous rights is not recognized as a core element of what the solution to addressing catastrophic climate change is. That's a big failing. We also know there are huge questions that still remain around who pays and who is responsible for the emissions that have already been released into the atmosphere. So we know that developed nations have emitted the majority of emissions that have put us into the kind of dire situation that we're currently in. And so there's a fair share question. Are these countries, these developed nations, really willing to pay their fair share? And there's nothing in the text that says we will, as developed nations, pay disproportionately more to ensure the developing nations that want to follow through on their national commitments to emission reductions actually have the resources to do so. So that's still a key piece in there. It's related to another element of the conversation that folks might have heard about, which is really around this loss and damage conversation. So imagine the small island nations having to deal with sea level rise or developing nations like the Philippines, for instance, having to deal with an increased frequency and severity of massive weather events. Who is responsible and who helps to compensate for the losses that are being felt by countries that are most heavily impacted by climate change, which are often the least resourced nations? So the loss and damage section of the talks does not explicitly say this is how compensation, in a sense, is going to be paid and how we're going to take accountability for the losses that these countries are facing. And the U.S. was one of the key stakeholders in arguing to kind of keep some of the stronger elements of the policy out of the text because, for instance, it could have been argued that this would be a mechanism for holding major emitting industries and specifically corporations, often U.S.-based corporations, responsible for global emissions. So that's really a gap. And then there was an element that's a little bit of a mixed bag, which is around forests. Forests are really included in a strong way in the deal in terms of recognizing ecosystem value. A lot of folks fought hard to get in that text so that forests aren't just considered these kind of landscapes that have a number of carbon sticks that we need to protect just purely because of the carbon equation. The challenge is that the mechanism that is likely to be used to protect forests is a market-based mechanism. And this kind of takes us back to one of the bigger picture points, and it's not a surprise that coming out of the Paris talk, there are so many vested interests that are really committed to trying to only do as much as required. And so this sense of we don't really want to change business as usual. We want to kind of get this monkey off our back, so let's see what the least we can do is. That is not the level of ambition that we need to be seeing from President Obama or any of the other leaders that were there for the climate talks. What we need to be seeing is a drastic shift away from a carbonized economy. We need to be keeping fossil fuels in the ground. We need to be keeping forests standing, and we need to be learning to take leadership from communities that are at the forefront of feeling the impacts of climate change and have been developing solutions but do not have the same level of access and power and resources to kind of make these top-down plays that we sometimes see from diplomats proposing these types of things. So that's really our opportunity coming out of the talks, is to say, it was great. We all came to agreement in Paris. There are some beautiful words on paper, and there's some placeholders for real action. But as each of us returns to all of our different nations all around the world, the momentum that got our leaders into the position to come to consensus in Paris needs to be the momentum that we use to continue to leverage much deeper changes to business as usual, to our entire kind of carbonized economy, so that we see the solutions that are commensurate with the scale of the challenges we face with climate change.
Wow. Well, it took, you know, more than 20 years of these COP meetings for these diplomats to come to the point to recognize that global warming is serious and eventually we'll have to get out of the carbon age. And that eventually extends past 2050, as far as I can figure out. Lindsay Allen, as we wrap up, I wish you could tell us a couple of stories from Paris of the action outside the official negotiations. Did the voice of the people get a chance despite fears of terrorism?
Yes, there was. It was really interesting to see the way that dissent was cracked down on in Paris, because I think it made it so much more clear that no matter what the conditions were, you cannot silence this movement, because there is too much at stake. You know, even the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees, we're talking about hundreds of millions of people who would be displaced and affected by catastrophic climate change. So that was the pulse that you could feel, whether you were inside the credentialed blue zone in the UN negotiations, where almost 500 people on the last Wednesday of the talks risked having their badges revoked and their organizations were, you know, kicked out, to walk through the corridors where the diplomats were making decisions, to say equity is a core issue, to say the inclusion of rights is critical, to say 1.5 needs to be our target, to say countries aren't doing enough, to say don't get lost in the weeds and don't argue and expect this tit for tat when the climate is too critical of an issue for the entire globe. You know, so you see this beautiful, vibrant, vocal movement willing to risk their badges all the way to the streets, where you see this red line action that, despite the protests being banned, the French officials actually changed their position because they knew there was no way to stop the organizing that was going on, to say these are the red lines that this climate agreement cannot cross. So it was this beautiful, vibrant, hard to articulate, but you can feel that this was the heartbeat of our movement, and it could not be silenced because of fears of terrorism. And this is all about the world we want to create, which is not a world based on fear. It's a world based on our vision and equity and being real about understanding our connection with the entire planet. And that was very much a vibrant part of all of the movement moments that happened in Paris.
We have been listening to Lindsay Allen, just back from the Paris Climate Talks. And Lindsay is the leader of the Rainforest Action Network. And you can keep up with that activism at rand.org. Thank you so much, Lindsay.
Thank you, Alex.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Are you wondering how to cope with climate worry and maybe some other threats? There is a new online seminar series coming up with some guests you might want to hear. Let's get the details from our Radio EcoShock friend, Carolyn Baker. Carolyn, welcome, and who's coming to the party?
Well, who's coming to the party, this wonderful party called Living Your Passion and Purpose in the Face of Humanity's Greatest Challenge, are people such as Andrew Harvey, who is the founder of the Institute for Sacred Activism, Canadian Stephen Jenkinson, who's the author of Die Wise and the film Griefwalker, Derek Jensen, who many folks know as the founder of Deep Green Resistance, myself, Linda Bazell, who's an eco-psychologist in Southern California, Dar Jamal, who is a famous climate writer for the Truth Out website, Jenea Donaldson, the producer of Peak Moment TV, Dr. Mick Collins from the UK, who wrote a wonderful book called The Unselfish Spirit, and Becca Martinson, wife of Chris Martinson, the financial online blogger. Becca is a therapist and a life coach. And these very heart-opening sessions are offered live, and they're recorded for later viewing. They're each going to be 2 hours, and then after we feature the recorded interview by our speaker, we're going to have that person come back on live, and we're going to have discussion, question and answer and a lot of exercises that we can do together to, I think, create a nice online community with each other.
Okay, and the focus of it will be what?
The focus of it will be our feelings and our responses to catastrophic climate change, to the global crisis in general, as opposed to more facts, more information, more science. This is going to be a very intimate and compelling kind of venue. It's going to focus on inner explanation and what we want to do together in the face of humanity's greatest threat.
So this all comes by computer. People sign up and then they, how does it work?
Well, you go to my website, carolynbaker.net, and right there in the middle of the page is the flyer and a place for you to click to register. You can go there and register in a flash, and you're going to be able to get these recordings after you register and after they are actually aired on the show. And you'll be able to refer to them in the future. And I think this is going to be a great opportunity to create, as I said, an online community that goes deeper and goes beyond just touching base with each other on Facebook.
Right. We watched what happened in Paris. We know that's not going to solve the global climate crisis. And when we start looking at our kids and looking around the other species, this stuff really touches us deep. And we don't really have much advice on what to do with those feelings.
That's absolutely right. And what we're trying to do here in this online webinar is to help us connect more deeply with ourselves, with each other, and with the Earth. And I think it's going to be a unique kind of experience. I don't know anything like it that's going on online in relation to this particular topic. So we want everyone to join us for this very, very exciting and groundbreaking event.
So if somebody has a deep question they've been dying to ask, is there a way they're going to get that into this?
Yes, absolutely. We're going to have lots of interaction. There'll be chat. There'll be live questions. Everyone will be able to have their voice and ask and make comments as we go along. So in that respect, it's not just an experience where you're sitting and listening, but you are actually interacting with the speaker and with other participants.
And you mentioned if people have to work or they live in a wildly different time zone, they can still get this. How do they do
right.
that?
Right. Oh, absolutely. If you miss a session or, you know, you're in New Zealand and, you know, it's the middle of the night for you, not to worry because you're going to have access to the recording later on.
Okay. One last shot. What is the website where people go if they want to look into this and maybe sign up for it?
My website, carolynbaker.net. That's Carolyn with a Y, www.carolynbaker.net.
Well, good. I wanted listeners to hear about this because I haven't heard of any assembly of that kind of crew, that kind of caliber,
right,
all in one place talking. So I think this could be a really worthwhile event. I'll add a link in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much, Carolyn.
Thank you, Alex.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You can listen to this program again on SoundCloud after Wednesday and find all the links to guests and topics in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Like the fossil age, we are out of time. Thank you for listening. Be sure and join us next week on Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to Radio Free Radicals.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Rafif Ziada is a London-based poet and activist. Her newest CD, We Teach Life, combines poetry and music and makes a deliberate connection between activism and art. Drawing on her experience growing up in Lebanon as a Palestinian refugee, she says that central to the theme of her writing are the multiple sieges on Palestinians, but especially the Israeli siege on Lebanon in 1982 and the current siege on Gaza. A video of Ziada reciting her poem, We Teach Life, has garnered almost 900,000 views on YouTube since 2011. Activist Hazem Jamjoom recently interviewed Rafif Ziada in London for the Electronic Intifada. We begin today's podcast and the interview with We Teach Life, the title track from her new CD.
Today, my body was a TV massacre. Today, my body was a TV massacre that had to fit into sound bites and word limits, filled enough with statistics to counter measured response. So I perfected my English, and I learned all my UN resolutions. I perfected my English, and I learned all my UN resolutions. But still, he looks me straight in the eyes and asks me, Ms. Ziada, wouldn't everything be resolved if you Palestinians would just stop teaching so much hatred to your children? Pause. I look inside of me for strength to be patient. I look inside of me for strength to be patient, but patience is not at the tip of my tongue as the bombs drop over Gaza. Patience has just escaped me. Pause. Remember to smile. Rafif, you're on camera. Remember to smile. Remember to keep it together. Pause. We teach life, sir. We teach life, sir, after they have occupied the last skies. We teach life, sir, after they have built their settlements and their apartheid walls. After the last skies. We teach life, sir. But today, today my body was a TV'd massacre that had to fit into sound bites and word limits. And they need a hook. They tell me every journalist needs a hook. They need a personal story, just a human story. How about you give us a story of a woman from Gaza who needs medication, just medication. Shh, we're not speaking about that word occupation. Shh, don't mention that word apartheid, just medication. How about you give us a story of a woman from Gaza who just needs medication? Maybe she can be pretty. Maybe she can speak English without an accent. Just a human story, a human story. This is not political, you see. How about you? How about you? Do you have enough bone broken limbs to cover the sun? Hand me over your dead. Hand me over your dead and give me the list of their names, but make sure that it's in 1,200 word limits. Today, my body was a TV massacre that had to fit into sound bites and word limits. It was made to hook those that are desensitized to terrorist blood, but they felt sorry. They felt sorry for the cattle over Gaza, so I give them statistics and UN resolutions, and I speak their language. I give them statistics and UN resolutions, and I speak their language. We condemn, we deplore, we reject, we condemn, we deplore, we reject. These are not two equal sides, occupier and occupied. These are not two equal sides, colonizer and colonized. And 100 dead, 200 dead, 1,000 dead. I recount, I recount, I recount, and remember to smile, not terrorist. Remember to smile, not exotic. And I recount, I recount, I recount. 100 dead, 200 dead, 1,000 dead. 100 dead, 200 dead, 1,000 dead. Is anyone out there? Will anyone listen? I wish I could just wail over their bodies. I wish I could just run barefoot in every refugee camp and hold every child, cover their ears so they wouldn't have to hear the sound of bombing for the rest of their life the way that I do. I wish I could just wail over their bodies.
run barefoot in every refugee camp and hold every child, cover their ears so they wouldn't have to hear the sound of bombing for the rest of their life, the way that I do. Because let me just tell you, there's no soundbite. No matter how good my English gets, no soundbite. No matter how well I practice, no soundbite, no soundbite, no soundbite, no soundbite will bring them back to life, and no soundbite will fix this. We teach life, sir. We teach life, sir. We Palestinians wake up every morning to teach the rest of the world life, sir.
This is Hazem Jamjoum from Electronic Intifada, and I have the honor and privilege to be interviewing Rafif Ziada today, renowned Palestinian activist and poet. Thanks for being with us today, Rafif.
Thank you, Hazem.
I first met you as an activist, and a very active one at that. And then all of a sudden, you were dropping, at that time, it was All Shades of Anger, which was an extremely powerful poem, continues to be an extremely powerful poem. I also remember in 2006 when you dropped that poem at the CUPE Ontario convention right before what became the first boycott resolution of any trade union in, you know, the quote-unquote Western world. I think only COSATU from South Africa had come before that. And people from that convention actually had said that your poem was part of the reason they voted the way they voted. So, but how did you get into poetry? How did that poem come about? How did sort of Rafif the poet emerge?
I'd been writing poetry my entire life. I think, like as a lot of Palestinians, Mahmoud Darwish's poetry was central in my upbringing, being a refugee to Lebanon, and leaving after the siege of Beirut and the invasion of Lebanon. Books and poems like Memory of Forgetfulness shaped my entire childhood, and they were a form of survival. Like the line about your dead and wounded are ammunition within you is one of the poems that I memorized before I could even speak Arabic properly, I think. So poetry had always been central in my life. I started writing at a young age. The difficult transition for me was writing in English, because English is not my first language by any stretch of the imagination, and I used to make a lot of mistakes. And also, I've never studied formally performance, like standing on a stage, projecting microphones, or any of that. So it was a difficult process to get over all my insecurities and fears and do that. But it was the one incident at York University that really pushed me. When someone kicked me in the stomach and said, "You deserve to be raped before you have your terrorist children." And it was actually that evening that I performed Shades of Anger. I wrote it the same day, performed it that evening, and the entire time my eyes were closed. And I opened my eyes at the end of the performance to see a standing ovation. Wow. So I thought something must be going right.
Mm-hmm. Well, something definitely was going right. Can you tell us a bit about, since then, if you've sort of developed a process for writing? I mean, two of your most famous poems, one we've just talked about, and then We Teach Life, Sir, you introduce, even on the CD that we're here talking about, which is named after that poem, We Teach Life, starts with how this poem came about. Is that usually kind of how this happens, or is there, or will there be some intentionality of, I really feel like I want to write something today, or will something take a long time to write and edit and revise?
I write in my head quite often. I also speak to myself when I'm walking and when I'm on the train. I speak poetry to myself to see what it sounds like, and it really freaks people out on the tube in London. I should probably stop doing that. So there's multiple ways. Sometimes I just write on napkins in restaurants and try to keep them. It is very incident-heavy, my poetry generally. It'll be from watching the news or something has just happened and I feel compelled to say something about it. I've been trying lately, and I think on this CD, I hope people feel it more. I've been trying to hone the craft of the writing a little bit more, work on the images, the metaphors, the things I'm using, and it's a work in process. But I wouldn't say I have one process of doing it. There's multiple ones.
I see. Well, also kind of back to you know, Rafif the activist and Rafif the poet, there's, I guess, an age-old, hopefully not particularly asinine conversation about, you know, the relationship of art to politics and politics to art. We were talking earlier about the film Amandla, about revolutionary song in South Africa, where there's this key conversation about whether revolutionary art creates revolutionary situations or revolutionary situations allow for the popularity and creation of revolutionary art. It must be something you think about, since you sort of embody this particular conversation as well, in that even just in the day, the way your day or your week is divided, and the different kinds of work that you're doing, whether it's this kind of creative poetry or the nitty gritty headache of organizing. How do you think about the relationship between these things?
It's a difficult question, largely because in the way it's posed sometimes, people make it seem like you have multiple personalities and that they don't talk to each other or aren't integrated in any way.
I just did that, I think.
and I think, I see myself as one person, generally, that writes and organizes, and both influence each other very, very much. And I think this idea of dividing ourselves into different sections is quite a modern one. I think of people like Ghassan Kanafani, for example, who were spokespeople for organizations and amazing activists and wrote history books and history and also wrote novels. I like this idea of us being multidimensional. It's hard. I wish there were more hours in the day that I could devote to poetry and my activism. I also need to have a paid regular job, and I have a whole other hat as an academic as well. But I think that for me, all of these aspects actually build on each other, and I try to get the one to support the other rather than take away from it.
So that's on you, on your personal level. Mm. On a broader level of social change and social transformation that has some degree of intention behind it, and some degree of also, you know, conflict and contradiction and differing ideas. Where do you see? I mean, I'll tell you that, and we'll talk a little bit later about some of the particular poems on this CD. But where you're clearly using your poetry as a vehicle for an argument of some kind or another, right? And actually, in most cases, it's a very clear argument. As beautiful as it is, and as incredible some of the imagery that you will kind of couch it in, you're delivering a message through your poetry. And, you know, we've all heard also critics say things like, you know, art should be separate from politics, mm-hmm. art should be for its own sake, these kinds of things, which clearly is not where you stand on this. Just listening to the CD, it's quite obvious. But how do you think about those kinds of, that larger relationship between art and politics?
For me, spoken word specifically, and the reason I chose this form specifically is because it is about communication to an audience. Mm-hmm. It's not a form that's very much inwards, about just the writing process, but also about delivering it and having an audience understand you and feel something when they're hearing it. So I do care about communication. I'm certainly not doing it just for myself. I think there are ways to have messages in what you do that are thoughtful, sometimes inspiring, and I hope to inspire, but sometimes they're also not inspiring. Sometimes they're about a feeling, and that feeling could be of hurt or disappointment or just how tiring the struggle can be. I think all of this range of emotions is important to have in poetry, because I think at the end of the day, we need to be honest and truthful about the different modes of being that you go through when you're an organizer or a non-organizer. But all of these things need to be present, and I try really hard to present all of them. It's just difficult for me to separate out the politics, because it's ingrained in my entire history. Like, being born into a war and an invasion in Lebanon growing up undocumented as a Palestinian refugee, seeing First Intifada, Second Intifada, the current popular uprising that's going on the ground, it just speaks to me and it's something that I want to write about. I think there's something extremely powerful about the role of art in sustaining us as human beings. And if you look at social movements generally, what we remember of them is the poetry, the music, the art, the theater. So I think those moments generate a specific art form. I don't think it's necessarily the other way around. We're like, but I think the fact that this is what we remember of social movements for me is very meaningful.
Yeah, and I mean, also, I guess, I think often also of, you know, Sheikh Imam songs and Ashiqeen songs that also commemorate a particular event that I may not even have known about had it not been for this song, or a particular person who once they're martyred or murdered, they're commemorated through song. And then we think of Che Guevara through the Sheikh Imam song about Che Guevara, or we think about the siege of Beirut, and we have all of these facts and figures, and the Ashiqeen song about Ishhad Ya Alam Alayna Wa Beirut becomes the image that we remember the moment through. On this level also, I want to kind of ask you about criticism. Does, you know, Mahmoud Darwish once said something quite interesting where he sort of told the Arab press to stop showering Palestinian artists with love and to start treating them as artists by criticizing them and offering criticism so that this art can grow. This was 20 years ago or more. Do you think that's changed? Do you find kind of people engage with your work on a critical level in a way that's clear to everyone involved that this is about allowing you and other Palestinian artists' work to develop and grow and change even?
Well, 2 points I'd make. I've been so happy and thankful for the support that I've gotten from Palestinians and pro-Palestine activists around the world for the work that I do. It's been really, it's given me a lot of strength. And that's also because I have an entire folder of hate mail that I get on a regular basis from Zionists who attack everything that I do. At one point, it was even difficult to go to university because you'd have a crew of like Zionist students following you, tracking every move that you do, just trying to intimidate you not to do activism. So the support is really needed and really necessary, and I think sometimes we forget that we also need to support each other and different forms of art. Having said that, I think, yes, there is a way in which, because the topic is Palestine, people are fearful of engaging with art as an art form. And I'm trying to break through that. At the same time, it's difficult. You need an environment for art criticism.
Yeah.
You need an engagement on a community level, not just an individual level. So I have a few people I really trust and admire who I send the poems to give me feedback on the poetry, to tell me whether it's making sense or not making sense. And that's really helpful. And the same on the music level as well, because this CD has music on it too. I think, does that answer the question?
Yeah. I mean, it's also interesting that because it's, and again, it's like the Darwish's point is kind of, it seems to be well taken in a way, is because it's about Palestine, your art will be perceived along those lines of either hate mail or fan mail. And then it's left to a small number of people to also kind of treat it as art and talk about it as art and give you feedback on it as art, not just as an artistic vehicle for this struggle.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's difficult to draw the lines, I think, from what I've seen in a lot of the emails that I get. It's difficult to draw the line. But actually, I've gotten some really good feedback on this CD since it's come out. It's been really encouraging feedback, people liking the transition from the first CD to the second one, but also some wonderful criticism that I've taken to heart.
Wow. So let's talk about this CD. This is We Teach Life. The first CD, Hadil, was widely beloved. And something tells me this one is going to be even more beloved. the poem itself, We Teach Life, went viral. I remember checking once and then checking back a week later and the numbers. And of course, I was very happy for you.
Thank you.
And still am. But did you expect this particular poem of all of your poems to be one that people would kind of, it would resonate in this way?
La, I had no idea.
Yeah.
I actually performed the poem. I had no idea it was being filmed. And it was an evening here in London where Remy Kenazi was actually performing. And I was performing right before him, so I didn't even know the camera was there. I went into an academic conference right afterwards where I didn't have internet access and I was presenting a paper, so I was very stressed out. And I came out of that 3 days later, and the video had something like 300 hits. And I really had no idea that was going to happen. I'm glad it did, and I'm thankful that poem resonated with people in the way that it did. It took me a long time to do this recording, though, because I felt a huge responsibility after that. I wanted to put out something that included that poem because it has never actually been recorded.
That's right.
Only the video has made it out. So I wanted to do that justice, but also chronicle the time in between that poem to today.
Yeah.
And that's what I tried to do in this new CD.
The electronic intifada.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Manji Daoudi of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, who discusses the response of the Muslim community to a threefold increase in hate crimes targeting mosques and individual Muslims across the U.S. Mike Lawler, Connecticut Undersecretary for Criminal Justice Policy and Planning, who explains the rationale behind proposed juvenile justice reforms that many see as a model for the entire nation. And author Les Leopold, who talks about his new book titled Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year after Presidents Barack Obama and Raul Castro agreed to normalize diplomatic relations, Cuba is looking for economic relief and new investment. Yet the announcement of closer U.S.-Cuba ties prompted a new flow of refugees out of Cuba and a large influx of American tourists visiting Cuba for the first time. A recent flurry of fiscal agreements could bolster the Cuban economy. Paris Club creditor nations have forgiven $8.5 billion of Cuba's $11.1 billion debt and restructured payments on the remainder with easy terms. But the deal imposes severe penalties if Cuba falls behind again. Cuba and the U.S. agreed to resume commercial air flights between the two countries once a new protocol on safety inspections is agreed to. President Obama has expressed an interest in visiting Cuba if he can freely meet with Cuban dissidents. Earlier in 2015, the U.S. and Cuba signed agreements on environmental protection and drug enforcement. Many Washington officials, including the Secretaries of Agriculture, Commerce, and State, along with dozens of lawmakers, have visited Havana, the highest-level government contacts in decades. U.S. and Cuban officials have even started discussing their oldest grievances, opening negotiations to settle billions of dollars in U.S. property claims and Cuban counterclaims. James Williams of the group Engage Cuba told the Washington Post that the Cubans have been overwhelmed with a surge of interest in commercial ventures, with companies making overtures but not a lot of clarity about how to make a deal. The Kurdish population, over 30 million strong across the Middle East, remains the largest ethnic group in the world without their own nation-state. But optimism is growing for the future establishment of a new Kurdish republic, given the Kurds' strong alliance with Washington and recent military victories over Islamic State militants in both Iraq and Syria. For Syrian Kurds, the four-year civil war has created new opportunities, with the carving out of enclaves in regions that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has relinquished. In these areas, the Kurds have moved to establish autonomy that includes advancing Kurdish language education, a movement toward gender equality, and decision-making structures generally inclusive of Arabs and the other groups living in their areas of control. But there is a dark side, too. Human rights groups accuse Syrian Kurdish militias of recruiting child soldiers and destroying Arab villages. And in both the Iraqi and Syrian contexts, internal rivalries, autocratic tendencies, and fraught relations with Arab neighbors have slowed progress toward independence. Over the past 12 years, the rate of juveniles sentenced to prison or other correctional facilities in the U.S. dropped by 53%, according to a new analysis from the Pew Charitable Trusts. Crunching data from the U.S. Department of Justice, Pew calculated that the juvenile sentencing rate fell in 49 states between 2001 and 2013, with the rate dropping by 50% or more in 26 states. The rate increased only in North Dakota and the District of Columbia. Connecticut is the leader in juvenile justice reform, where juvenile incarceration fell by 75% without a concurrent spike in violent crimes or any added costs for taxpayers. The state's innovative juvenile justice initiatives are discussed in an interview later in this broadcast. Researchers from the Pew Trust attributed the falling incarceration rate to a decrease in violent crime among juveniles and recent reforms in the juvenile justice system. The Justice Policy Institute says diverting juveniles from prison and the use of more alternative sentences has had a real impact. Jason Zeidenberg, director of research and policy at the Institute, believes the success of juvenile justice reforms could provide a blueprint for the country to achieve its goal of reducing mass incarceration for adults. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Since the November 13th ISIS attacks in Paris that left 130 dead and 368 injured, followed by the December 2nd San Bernardino, California mass shooting by a radical Islamist couple that killed 14 and wounded 22 others, the incidence of anti-Muslim hate crimes in the U.S. has increased dramatically. According to the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino, the number of attacks on Muslims in their houses of worship has risen almost threefold and include assaults on women dressed in traditional veils or hijabs, vandalism, arson, and shootings. While the number of anti-Muslim crimes over the past 5 years has averaged 12.6 per month, in the 4 weeks following the Paris attacks, the number rose to 37. According to news reports, a severed pig's head was thrown from a car at a mosque in Philadelphia. A pregnant Muslim woman who was wearing a headscarf in San Diego was hit in the stomach while walking down the street, and an Uber driver in Pittsburgh was shot by a passenger who thought he was a Muslim. An anti-Muslim hate crime in Connecticut took place on November 14th, when a 48-year-old man was arrested after he allegedly fired multiple shots from guns he owns at a mosque near his home in the city of Meriden. No one was hurt in the attack, and the FBI later found anti-Muslim messages posted on his Facebook account. Your reporter spoke with Manji Dawoodi, executive director of the Connecticut chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, who discusses how local mosques and national groups are responding to the rise in hate crimes and concern about the toxic effect of hateful rhetoric coming from many of the candidates running for the Republican Party presidential nomination.
Primarily, our concern is with the safety and security of our community as places of worship, as individuals. We have quite a good number of our women in our community. They wear the headscarf, and so they are easily identified as Muslims. And so we are concerned that they might be a target of hate incidents or hate crimes. There's an increased number of attacks on specifically on houses of worship all across the country. And this is something that we as a community have to face, and as a country, I think we need to take a hard look at ourselves, examine the real causes that is putting people in harm's way, innocent people. Everyone has to share the responsibility for this, and I think our political leaders need to take a look at themselves and seriously consider the words that they utter in the campaign trail specifically, that those words do carry weight, and they might contribute to the atmosphere that we live in, that facilitates and makes people who are at the fringe extremists find in those words, in some of these politicians' rhetoric, a way for them to act out on those fears, on the ignorance, while some of the politicians think that attacking minorities and attacking specifically Muslims might increase their polls numbers, might increase their money in their bank accounts, but it has other consequences, which is putting the safety and security of innocent people on the line.
Republican presidential candidates, foremost Donald Trump, have targeted Muslims with his campaign rhetoric. First of all, talking about how the U.S. military should target terrorists, families, the women and children of terrorists or accused terrorists. We've had, of course, his infamous statements recently where he's called for a ban on all Muslim immigration to the United States, as well as previous statements calling for a database of all Muslims living in this country. What is your reaction to a major political party in this country and their foremost, most popular candidate espousing such hateful messages to the American people?
Right. I think we can safely say that Donald Trump and Ben Carson and some of these Republican candidates are, to tell you the truth, are dangerous for our national security. I mean, the rhetoric that they are using, the hateful message that they are giving to a certain segment of our society, that segment is receiving it, is cheering for it, and is embracing it, is dangerous. It is dividing us. It is putting our community at risk, and it should be condemned, and it should be rejected with very clear message that there's no ambiguity, there's no buts. Overall, I think the leadership on the Republican side came out and rejected what Donald Trump was suggesting, from preventing Muslims from coming to this country and trying to blame all Muslims for the acts of a few terrorists. But I think overall we are disappointed in the Republican leadership. They have allowed this to happen for quite a long time. This rhetoric accusing the Muslim community overall and speaking in language that is, quite frankly, is divisive and it is demeaning, degrading to our people and our religion. A great faith like the faith of Islam has been for centuries, been respected around the world, is being followed by 1.5 billion Muslims. The overwhelming majority of them are peaceful Muslims, just like anybody else, who go on about their life every day. But to allow some of these candidates who are competing for the highest position in the land, in the United States, to be talking that language is really disappointing. So we think that the Republican Party is at a crossroad. We think and we hope that they will make the right choice eventually, is to cut any candidate that does not adhere to the norm, if you will, to adhere to a principled message that respects the rights of others, that respects all religious minorities in this country. I think they need to cut them loose. I think they need to distance themselves from them, even if it is at the expense of losing the presidential election. I think they might lose the election but save the party and save the country. But I think if they allow this to happen and to go on, I think that eventually they will lose the elections and they will lose the party. So I hope that they come to their senses, and they come to their senses quickly.
That was Manji Dawoodi, Executive Director of the Connecticut Chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Learn more about how American Muslims are responding to a rise in hate crimes by visiting our Between the Lines website,
at btlonline.org. Until a few years ago, Connecticut was among the most backward states in the nation regarding its treatment of juveniles in the criminal justice system. It was among three states, with New York and North Carolina, that treated all juveniles 16 years and older as adults, regardless of the criminal charges. Teenagers were often the victims of abuse in prison, and their public criminal records, even when they didn't result in prison time, followed them the rest of their lives. Records which made them ineligible for student loans, approval to live in public housing, or to receive benefits from government programs like food stamps. Recidivism for these young offenders was high. Legislation to raise the age at which offenders would be adjudicated as adults was raised to 18 and enacted before Connecticut Democratic Governor Dana Malloy took office in 2011. The governor, recently elected as chair of the Democratic Governors Association, has now proposed going further, designating all those 20 years of age or under involved in the state's criminal justice system to be considered a juvenile. Among other measures, the governor proposes allowing some defendants up to age 25 with low-level offenses to have their cases heard confidentially, their criminal records sealed, and the possibility of having those records expunged. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mike Lawler, Governor Malloy's Undersecretary for Criminal Justice Policy and Planning at the state's Office of Policy and Management. Here, Lawler, a former state representative, explains the rationale behind these proposed juvenile justice reforms that many observers believe could serve as a model for the rest of the nation.
Governor Malloy is completely convinced that people under 21 are definitely not fully formed adults. And under 25, it's pretty clear that your brain is not fully developed. So the issue is, can we change the criminal justice system to deal with the reality that young people are not fully culpable if they break the law? And so the governor has seen this in Germany. He was there earlier this year, and up to age 21, the German courts make a decision whether or not someone should be prosecuted as an adult or as a juvenile. And I think the trend is definitely in that direction. The science definitely indicates that. And I think the governor wants there to be a conversation in our state whether or not we should have special rules governing people under 21, in addition to that, special protections for people under 25 when they do these relatively minor kinds of offenses that potentially could affect their entire life, given the fact that everything you do is easily accessible online. And so updating our criminal justice system to reflect modern realities is a priority for the governor. And I think we're very confident the legislature will agree that this is the right thing to do, and we'll have a very different system.
Can you give some examples of the kinds of crimes that 18 to 21-year-olds commit where they could be treated as juveniles if these changes go into effect?
So every state has a juvenile justice system, and every state has a rule that says that the most serious crimes get prosecuted in adult court, even for people as young as 15, 14, 13 years old, including Connecticut. So murder, for example, would automatically go to adult court. But the vast majority of crimes that are committed are not in that category. And so the question is, if you're 17 years old and you get caught possessing drugs or selling drugs or breach of peace or whatever, then should the fact that you've been arrested and the fact that you've been prosecuted and convicted make it impossible later on in life for you to succeed, right, in a job, in a family, whatever it happens to be? And so what the governor has said is that we know based on the science that your brain is not fully developed until you have reached age 25. And so should we have a justice system that acknowledges that reality and on a case-by-case basis decide who should be prosecuted, who should be handled in a juvenile system where the consequences are not lifelong? And that's really what we're talking about. So he's proposed that the legislature talk about this, think about it, come up with a system that makes a cutoff at age 21 or 20 or whatever it happens to be, but acknowledge that people under 25 should be treated differently. And so we're very confident that we can do this. The extraordinary success of Connecticut's Raise the Age initiative has really provided the foundation for the governor's goal of saying, well, maybe 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds should be put in the same category. Because if Our goal is to reduce crime. All we know for sure is that, at least in Connecticut, we've been extraordinarily successful using this very focused initiative for younger offenders. And if we can add 18, 19, 20-year-olds to this mix, maybe we can get the same results.
Michael Eller, what kind of changes do you think we'll see in Connecticut if these changes go through of young people being considered juveniles in the criminal justice system?
It's related to in a change the way our government, our society deals with young people who are acting out, right? So 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago, they're happy to be arrested. They're more likely to get suspended from school or expelled from school. And that's not happening now. We realize that arresting, expelling, suspending children from school is making it more likely that they get into trouble, get arrested, get incarcerated down the road. We know that for sure. We've had these national studies in Texas in particular that shows that these decisions, if you're trying to reduce crime, then doing things like suspending, expelling, arresting children in school makes it more likely they'll commit crime in the future. Okay. So if you can stop doing that, you'll have less crime in the future. We know that for sure.
That was Mike Lawler, Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy's Undersecretary for Criminal Justice Policy and Planning. Find more information and commentary on Connecticut's juvenile justice reform initiatives by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The American dream for many has turned into a nightmare, with millions of workers stuck in dead-end, low-paid jobs and few prospects for a brighter future. For the younger generation, lucky enough to afford a college education, many are now confronted by the stark reality of being burdened with tens of thousands of dollars in tuition debt and limited career opportunities. Inequality is at an all-time high in the U.S., with the most unequal income distribution across the entire industrialized world. One signpost of the major changes in the U.S. economy can be seen in the dramatic shift in the pay ratio between the top 100 CEOs and average workers, which was 45 to 1 in 1970, but today stands at 829 to 1. Other factors contributing to growing economic disparity include the deregulation of Wall Street, a tax code favoring the wealthiest Americans, the decline in the power of labor unions, the offshoring of good-paying manufacturing jobs, and the slashing of critical social safety net programs. While the trend of worsening inequality has been a feature of the U.S. economy over the last 35 years, the 2011 Occupy Wall Street movement, the ongoing campaign for a $15 minimum wage, and the popularity of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign are all indicators that many Americans are increasingly angry over diminished living standards and joining others to demand change. Your reporter spoke with Les Leopold, author, co-founder, and director of the Labor Institute in New York City, who talks about his new book titled Runaway Inequality, An Activist's Guide to Economic Justice, which urges the building of a new national progressive movement.
Between 1947 and 1980, roughly, as productivity went up in the United States, so did the real wage of the average worker. That's how you got that robust middle class. And virtually every segment of society improved. Yes, there were differences by race and gender, but there was improvement going on all over the place, which allowed us to tackle those problems. After 1980, a new economic policy came into the United States that was embraced by both political parties. And it was, we call it the Better Business Climate model. Academics call it neoliberalism, but it had three basic tenets. It was cut taxes primarily on the wealthy, cut back government regulations on the economy, and cut back social spending and labor rights so that people would have more incentive to go out and work. And this was supposed to lead to a tremendous economic boom. Profits would go up, investment would go up, and jobs and income would rise for everyone. But the dirty little secret was in that little patch of deregulation. Deregulating AT&T or trucking or airlines is one thing. They also deregulated finance. And that absolutely tore the economy apart. That's the primary driver of runaway inequality, because when they deregulated finance, they set in motion what we call financial strip mining. Rather than adding value to corporations, finance found ways to take money and wealth out of corporations and into Wall Street, so that by 2006, 40% of all corporate profits went to Wall Street firms. They only had 5% of the employment. They had 40% of all the profits. The core of the book, the analysis, is to show how this financial strip mining actually works. For me, it was an eye-opening story.
I think one of the most important points you bring out in the book is that record inequality in the United States is not a result of some accident of history or some natural economic cycle gone wrong, but our inequality is actually a natural outcome of conscious policies chosen by politicians from our two major political parties. When you look at what happened over these years, Les, do you believe the outcome that we've now seen with the divide between haves and have-nots growing ever wider is something that was desired by these political parties that signed on to what you call the better business climate?
I think it's a complicated story, because I think what happened was when they unleashed Wall Street, they set in motion a process that fed on itself. This financial strip mining is absolutely unbelievable, because when they deregulated, it allowed corporate raiders to come in and buy up companies by the bucketful. And after a while, this happened to thousands of companies. And they loaded these companies up with debt. It was like it's as if you bought a car and then with debt, and then the car pays back the loan instead of you paying back the loan. So, yes, the people who put the policy into place, I don't think, saw this coming. But once it started happening, then the rich financiers used all their lobbying muscle. Both political parties started to go after this money, this campaign money, and it became more and more deregulation. President after president deregulated Wall Street more and more and more, and more money got strip mined out of corporations into the coffers of Wall Street.
You close your book with a chapter titled An Open Letter to New Movement Organizers. Les, why don't you encapsulate the main message that you have there, that a progressive, multi-issue organizing drive has to happen to address all these issues simultaneously and get away from the single-issue organizing model,
exactly.
Silos and such.
Right. I've been engaged in dialogue with younger organizers, and it's been very fruitful. And there's a recognition now that the way we've organized ourselves for the last 30 years is good, but not good enough. We've been organized around single issues that I term silos. We're very, very good within the silos, but overall, we've been losing ground. And so the letter is a call to younger movement organizers to start thinking about building a broad national movement with a coherent agenda that cuts through the silos, that makes the silos more porous. This is a big challenge, because silos are supported often by foundations that have staff that are also broken into silos, and you get this kind of reinforcement again and again and again, but it's not going to work. We need a much broader mass movement that starts to talk about, in general, the country we want to see. I think the younger generation of organizers can do it. The talent's there, and I think we need to help them. I'm very fortunate I get a chance to go around and give a lot of talks to groups ranging from like 100 to 1,000. And at the end of the talks, I say, how many people here would like to be trained to be an economics educator the way the populace had? They had 6,000 of them back in the 1880s. We need about 30,000 now. And about 95% of the people raise their hands and volunteer. So this book is designed to be kind of a primer for those volunteers. It has questions at the end of each chapter. You can use it in a book club, a study guide. You can drive your relatives nuts over the holidays because, you know, it's got over 100 charts and graphs, so you'll be armed to the teeth. But really what we want to do is build a national economics education campaign to be the infrastructure for a broader movement.
That was Les Leopold, author of the new book titled Runaway Inequality, An Activist's Guide to Economic Justice. For more views on the causes of and antidotes to economic inequality in the U.S., visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've
been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Conference of the Herds. I confess to not watching the entire presidential debate. By 20 minutes, I could stand no more. I saw nothing more than a pack of dogs yelping fear, hatred, ignorance, and enmity at the world around them. They bayed at the moon, a chaotic chorus of blood, barking war, death, bombs, kill. It was as astonishing as it was ugly. There were no words. There were merely snarls at a world that dared outgrow them, that no longer regarded them as the moneyed masters of the universe. With few exceptions, they paid tribute to the ignorance that birthed the disaster in Iraq, or that nursed their CIA, MI5, ISI, and Saudi-trained and paid assassins now nipping at their heels. They growled at immigrants, even though all of them, save one, were sons or granddaughter of immigrants. That one, a grandson of slaves. Hounds may bay at the moon, but they can't move it an inch. Dogs may chase a bus, but they can't really catch one. These dogs of war may open the door to carnage, but it will be your sons and daughters who suffer and die on the blooded altar of political ambition. They will bury their charred remains, grant them a medal, and step over their shredded bodies in pursuit of vain political advantage. This war, started in imperial hubris, will wage until our grandchildren are elderly, no matter what. And these politicians will bay at the moon with more murder on their minds. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Watching political debates is not my thing. First of all, they're hardly really debates. They are more often than not a series of sound bites, often of promises that both speakers and listeners know won't be kept. They remind me of the classic Peanuts comics, where Charlie Brown runs at a football to kick it, and Lucy promises to hold the ball. We all know she won't. Politics in America ain't about the vote. It's about the money. It's about corporate power, not people's power. And the recent case of Citizens United has only exacerbated that trend. Ultimately, Americans adore and fear the rich. Devoid of princes and earls, they bow their peasant heads to the wealthy as if their very blood compels them. What else can explain the emergence of GOP frontrunner Donald Trump or the prominence of Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton? It ain't policies. And with Hillary, it certainly ain't either policy or personality. Two rich people, a billionaire and a millionaire. What have they got in common with average people? Republicans are running on rudeness and nastiness. Democrats are running on niceness, except for those in the Middle East, of course, and promises of jobs. Well, after NAFTA, those days are over. Both are for corporate power and corporate interests. The middle class is shrinking like seaweed on a seashore. It's embarrassing to even mention the working class. And no one mentions the state's wars against black Americans. It's like a gentleman's agreement not to be discussed, not to be touched, lest it frighten white voters. We are in the midst of the biggest, most diverse, broadest human rights movement since the 1960s. And the political response is a cynical silence. Surely it's so because they have no response, for the system rests on repression. It can't exist without exploitation, racism, state violence. So the choice remains, boorish or boring. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Tale of Two Men. Sometimes events occur which, although separate in locality, have features in common or, when compared, reveal a clarity that they would not possess apart. Cases in point. A. A young man, reportedly for the high crime of possessing a 3-inch knife, gets shot repeatedly until dead. His alleged offense? Causing fear in a cop. B. A middle-aged man, armed as if about to engage in war, drives to a Colorado Springs abortion clinic and engages in an hours-long rampage, shooting 9 and killing 3 before quitting his tantrum and submitting to arrest. Upon arrest, he is neither beaten, nor kicked, nor stomped, nor shot. I am, of course, referring to the cases of Laquan McDonald, 17, late of Chicago, Illinois, and of Robert L. Deer, 57, of Colorado Springs, site of a Planned Parenthood clinic. One, it must be said, black men receive hyper attention when in the presence of cops, so much so that, as a rule, white guys fade into the background of normality, unseen, unchallenged, even when they are carrying arsenals. Again, as in Deer's case, he drove to the clinic and then carried arms into the site of Planned Parenthood. One man was virtually invisible. Another man was hyper-visible. In such cases as these, both paths led to disaster. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yeah, you know, that classic, that Let There Be Drums. I think sometime I'm going to just, like, go home, and I'm going to sit there, and I'm going to say, we got to do this. We got to actually, I'm going to just turn it up as loud as I can and just blast it out my windows and see what my neighbors think, because those drums just drive me crazy, all right? And they're a call. They're a call to all the things that we need to face up to, that we need to do today and in the world. We have a very powerful show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Stephanie Myers, who is one of the editors of the book Atheist Guide to Christmas, and Paul Krassner, the satirist and writer Paul Krassner, who is one of the contributors to the book. Before that, we'll be hearing from Bob Avakian talking about the conspiracy to get the police off each and every time they kill someone. But opening the show up, I'm really, really happy to be bringing back to the show Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and one of the initiators of Rise Up October, the powerful three-day action that brought people from all over the country, including 100 families of people murdered by the police, to New York City to demand an end to police murder of black and brown people. Carl is joining us to talk about the recent mistrial that was declared in Baltimore in the trial of one of the cops that killed Freddie Gray last spring. And we're also going to be talking about what the hell is going on in Chicago. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into this, man, because I want to squeeze everything we can out of this, all right? And I want to go you just run with it, man. All right? What do you make? Okay. What do you make of this, man? They've been telling us all along, well, the cops are being put on trial, all the officials, everybody's like, yeah, well, look, Baltimore's this, it's a different Baltimore. This is, you know, we're putting these guys on trial. They're facing up. They're going to have to pay for what they did. They talked about this all the way through, and then all of a sudden, the first trial, they declare a mistrial. All right? What do you make of this, man?
Well, what I make of this is that the authorities in Baltimore felt forced to put some of their cops on trial. But putting a cop on trial is not the same as justice, and it's not the same as anybody paying for the murderous deeds that these killer cops carry out, especially in black and Latino communities. Because you look at this trial, this cop admitted that he talked to Freddie Gray and that Freddie told him he was hurt and needed medical attention and wanted to go to the hospital. He didn't get Freddie any medical attention or take him to the hospital. He saw that he was shackled and being bounced around on the floor of the police van. He put Freddie back up on the seat, but would not strap the seat belt to keep him from being bounced around. He admits this, and then he said, well, nobody on the police force pays much attention to the policy of strapping the prisoners in the van in. So it's basically like, yeah, I did it, but the people that I hang with always do that. So why are you blaming me? But that was a good enough defense because I don't have a lot of, I think that the way the prosecution carried out the case had a lot of problems, but some of the charges came down to very basic things. Did you provide him medical care when he asked for it? Did you buckle him into the seat? There were charges related to those inactions, and the jury couldn't even convict him on that. This comes down to police doing what they're supposed to do and then the system backing them up when they do it. That's what you have to say about this trial.
It's really important, too, because it's kind of a pivotal outcome here when, you know, people are looking at it, well, it's a mistrial and, you know, the judge will decide or they'll decide, they'll talk about it and they'll figure out what they're going to do. Are they going to proceed? Are they going to bring him back to trial? Are they going to make him come later? But actually, there's a lot of places where people were revealing this thing of that this was kind of a pivotal – this was a pivotal trial. The trial against this one cop was actually pivotal because
They were building the prosecution of the other five cops directly tied into this trial. And they were even meant to build on the conviction of Porter in order to have him then turn around and testify against the other cops. This was not sort of like, okay, well, we didn't make it on this one, but we'll get with these other five. This was a heavy, heavy scene in terms of what standards they've set and what they're actually trying to do.
Yeah, see, that's true. And one of the questions I have about the prosecution approach was that thing of building off of the trial of Porter, because one thing that the defense was able to use in this was that, well, look, I wasn't the one most to blame. There were other cops, like his supervisor was there, the driver, who's the one who actually administered the rough ride, they are the ones who are really responsible, was part of his defense. And they didn't even bring in and make much of a deal out of Gray's arrest. The fact that he was arrested for nothing more than seeing the cops and running, and then for a small knife that they found on him, that was their reason for arresting him, trussing him up like, shackling him the way that the slaves used to be shackled as they were being transported from one part of the plantation to another, and then giving him a rough ride. So that approach of we're going to build on the one who has lesser culpability to get to the ones who have more actually gave him an opening to blame somebody else. So that's a part of it. But then there was discussion that happened afterward that makes clear this thing about the role of the police, in my opinion. And that is they were discussing this question of police getting the benefit of the doubt. And all of the talking heads on the media were saying, well, of course, police deserve the benefit of the doubt when they get charged in cases like this. And then you have to say, why do they deserve the benefit of the doubt? What is it that gives them that kind of opening? Because this benefit of the doubt thing has been used to justify and cover up murder after murder committed by the police, horrific acts of brutality, but then you give them the benefit of the doubt and give them a pass on it. And it really comes down to a license to kill, and to kill in ways that give you what the role of the police is. Because look, Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, says the role of the police is not to serve and protect the people. It is to serve and protect the system that rules over the people, to enforce the relations of exploitation and oppression, the conditions of poverty, misery, and degradation into which this system has cast people and is determined to keep people in. The law and order that the police are about, with all of their brutality and murder, is a law and order that enforces all this oppression and madness. And that's a quote from Avakian out of his book of quotations and short essays titled Basics. And that's why this system gives the police the benefit of the doubt, because they need to have those frontline enforcers who are in position to protect the system and its relations of savage oppression and vicious exploitation against the people, hold people down so that the system can continue to rob them. That's what we're dealing with here. And that's why getting a cop indicted, rare though it is, because, you know, of the more than 1,100 people killed by police, several hundred of them unarmed and doing nothing wrong, there have only been 6 cases where cops, and I'm talking about this year alone, just in 2015, there are only 6 cases where cops who killed anybody have gotten indicted. That's why I say rare though it is. But a cop being indicted doesn't mean a cop is going to get punished for murderous deeds, because we've seen again and again where those indictments come down, but then the prosecutors forget how to prosecute. The court finds some obscure reason to throw the case out, and the killer cops continue to walk. So that's why it's very important that people pose, indict, convict, and send the killer cops to jail,
you know. And I know there are people who are believers in the system who say, well, it's wrong to put convict and sending to jail together with indictment, because doesn't the cop deserve a fair trial? Killer cops get far more than a fair trial. They usually get no trial, no matter how horrific their murderous deeds are. But even when they get indicted, the system bends over backwards to get them off.
Mm-hmm. Now, Carl, we're going to get into that a little bit in just a few minutes when we move on to Chicago. But I really wanted to pursue a couple things here, because as I was looking into and reading and thinking about what happened in Baltimore this past week, I kept thinking of the word bamboozle, because there's all of these things that come up, and it's very heavy. And you referred to one of them, where this statement that the mayor came out and like in all, you know, like, oh, there's calm. Meanwhile, she's got like thousands of cops on the streets. They, you know, they're all prepared. They're all beefed up, militarized and all this stuff. And they're looking to prevent any breakouts and all this stuff. But she had the audacity to make that statement that you referred to earlier. She said, justice is not a verdict. Justice is a process that we have to protect. Now, think about that. Think about that, man. What the – you know, let's talk about that a little bit, because it seems to concentrate some of what you were just talking about. Justice isn't a verdict. It doesn't matter what happens to you. As long as you went through the process, went through the show, let's talk bamboozled.
Yeah, exactly. You're supposed to see, well, they at least brought the cop to court and made him go through a trial. And then you're supposed to hope against hope that this time the cop will get convicted. Because after all, Freddie Gray was fine when he saw those cops in the neighborhood and ran away from them. And unfortunately, he didn't run fast enough or far enough and got caught. But he was fine before these cops came upon him. Then he comes upon the cops and his spine is nearly severed. He's unconscious. And in a week, he's dead. So obviously, it's right out in front that these cops, through their actions and their inactions, are the ones who are responsible for his death. So you hope that the system is going to do something. And the point is, they need to keep us hoping, believing and hoping, believing that the system can be made to work in our interest. Like, maybe it usually doesn't. But in a case like this, where so many people are watching, where there was obviously so much public anger over what happened, maybe this time is going to be the time that justice comes down. So that as long as you're thinking this system can work for you, then you're sucked in.
Mm-hmm.
They got you hooked. They got you caught. And they go at this again and again and again. And then, like you said, they had all the cops in the world backing up the bamboozlement that was being done, because they not only had all of the Baltimore City police out there, they got the Maryland State Police. They brought police from other jurisdictions outside of Baltimore into the city to make sure that they had the intimidating force to get those who didn't get sucked in by getting them to look at the process and not look at the question of another black man is dead and no police have been punished in any way. Well, if you're not taken in by that whole process thing, then look at the force that we have out here to keep you in place.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and Rise Up October. And we're talking about the first trial of the first cop that has been put on trial for killing Freddie Gray. And actually, he wasn't even charged with murder. He was charged with, what was it, manslaughter? Was that it?
He was charged with manslaughter and several charges related to dereliction of duty.
Right. And we're also going to be talking about what the hell is going on in Chicago. Now, Carl, one of the things I wanted to jump into, I want people to know, to think about this, because when we're talking about people being bamboozled, and this is actually not just – it's tactical and strategic on the part of the system. And there's a way that this is actually happening in a certain sense here, and it's related to what is going on in Chicago. In the New York Times article about the mistrial declared, the declaration of a mistrial in Porter, and that cop Porter and his murder of Freddie Gray in Baltimore – they made this point about you can't be knee-jerk in reacting to the declaration of a mistrial. After all, there are complex racial dynamics in play here. You have black authorities, black cops. Some of the defendants are even black. You know, the mayor's black, all this other stuff. And similar in Chicago, they talk about Rahm Emanuel. hey, come on, he's part of the Obama saviorship. This is kind of, he's down with the black people. And so you can't be talking about that this is actually a racialized thing. Let's talk about this, because in Baltimore, they made a big deal out of all this. It's not, you can't bring race into it. The people are just ignorant. They need to understand. We need to help them understand it has nothing to do with the color of their skin.
Well, I mean, that's more the bamboozlement. And it's a conscious part of the bamboozlement. The reason that there are black elected officials, black police chiefs, black authority figures in other positions in the system is actually to try to cover up the racial dynamics of the way in which the criminal injustice system operates. That's a very particular part of it, because it was really in the wake of the rebellions of the 1960s that you began to see this proliferation of black faces in high places. And a lot of what the rebellions were about was about the way that people were being abused and mistreated by the police. So you start putting black faces on this, and that can obscure it for people and make them think, oh, okay, well, it was about race, but it's not anymore because we got a black guy at City Hall. And it reached the height of, in 2008, there was a black president. But there was something very important that, again, Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, spoke to about that. He said that was the system playing its trump card, working to get people, especially black people, but other people who had become disaffected at the system, and especially in the deep, difficult situation that the system had gotten itself into, both domestically with the continued attacks on black people with the economic meltdown of 2007, but also around the world with the way in which the U.S. was widely being hated for the wars it was carrying out in the Middle East and other abusive and imperialistic moves it was making around the world. Well, we could put this black guy in there, and that could serve to shore up the U.S.'s reputation internationally and among people in this country, bring disaffected people back into the fold. But the thing that was pretty clear that people needed to understand, not just that it's happening, but understand why it's happening, is that you got this black president, this person that people felt, well, he will make this system operate differently towards black people. People also thought that he was going to stop the wars and change other things about the way the system operated. But that was just a black face on the same old system, continued to operate in the same way. And people are seeing that, but not understanding why. And people, as long as they don't see the class interest involved in all of this, they are going to continue to be taken in, tricked, fooled, and yes, bamboozled by this system as it continues to operate to keep this system and its oppression and exploitation of people, the majority of people in this country, and the overwhelming majority of people around the world in effect. And that's what we're dealing with, and that's what people have to come to understand.
Mm-hmm. Now let's turn to Chicago, Carl. This is very heavy. I mean, there is a major crisis erupting there, and if people haven't been paying attention, they need to be. You know, it's not just Laquan McDonald was actually just the thing that really burst the bubble in a lot of ways, but this has been coming up time and time again. I don't know how many family members I've spoken to on this show about their loved ones being murdered by the Chicago police and all these things that you read about. There is a major crisis erupting, and it's hitting hard at some of the very basic ways that this society, that this system rules over people, calling all kinds of things into question, as you were pointing out earlier. What do you make of this, Carl? What do you make of this whole situation there?
Well, this is a very important situation because, like you say, the Laquan McDonald murder and the video of it finally being released 1 year after the murder is what broke things out into the open. Because here you have a young man who the police gunned down in October of last year. It's caught on video. It's actually caught on several videos. The authorities knew about these videos
and the videos show real clear that the guy was murdered. Then the police put together reporting that says, well, he lunged at us and we had no choice but to gun him down. And this wasn't just said by the cop who fired the shots that killed him. This was said by all of the cops. And then a representative of the police goes on TV and gives this story. But it's all false. It's all concocted. And they have a video that shows that, but they keep the video covered up. They keep the video covered up, and it's known all the way up to the mayor's office that this video exists. They give the family a settlement of, I think, $5 million, hoping that they can buy them off and shut them up. But the battle to get this video out goes on, and then the video gets released, and all of a sudden, the day that the video is released, the cop gets indicted for murder, a murder that it's clear that he committed by looking at the video, which they've had for more than a year. And the reason I said several videos is because there were commercial establishments that had video that caught this as well. The police came to those establishments and said, we need your video because there was a police incident that we need to look at on it. They take the video from these establishments and then they return it with 86 minutes missing. And those 86 minutes cover the time frame when Laquan McDonald was murdered. So these cops erased that section of the video so that that would not be a way that it got out. But since the McDonald video has gotten out, a young man named Johnson, his family, Robert Johnson, I believe is his first name, his family, who had been fighting to get a video of his killing by police out, also for more than a year, it's gotten released. And it shows the police shooting him in the back as he runs from them. Those cops were never charged. And they say, well, it looks like he has a gun in his hand, which I've seen the video numerous times. There's no way you can say that. He seems to have his hand out as he runs, and they just shoot him in the back. But they exonerate that. See, and this kind of stuff had been going on forever. Not just the killings, but the brutality, the frame-ups. They had several different places where the police were running torture chambers. One of them was run by this cop, John Berg, who would take people and torture them until they confessed to various crimes, including crimes that landed people on death row. And a number of people have gotten their convictions overturned after that got exposed. Then, a couple years later, they learned that the Chicago cops were still running a torture chamber at a place called Holman Square. That's being dragged out into the open. All of this is going on, and then people are taking to the streets and demanding that all of the officials who had any role in this need to be thrown out of office, indicted, and going on trial and convicted for their role in the cover-up of this police terror. And then you've got the officials trying to figure out how we're going to hold the line. You've got the mayor firing some of his underlings and saying he's going to put together a task force to study the problem. You got the Department of Justice saying it's going to come in and investigate it, which at first the mayor was opposed to, but now he's saying, oh, of course I welcome a Department of Justice investigation. But all of this is aimed not at doing anything about the problem, but convincing the people that they're doing something so that things will go back to normal and that the police and everything, the criminal justice system and everything in Chicago can continue working the way that it used to work, which included unleashing brutality and terror, targeting especially Black and Latino communities.
Mm-hmm. Now, Carl, we got about 10 minutes, right? So I wanted to actually 10, okay. Exactly. So, and there's a lot of questions I got. But one of the things that you referred to earlier, and you were talking about Avakian and talking about the role of the police in society. And there's another piece that he wrote many years ago where he talked about the essence of dictatorship of all forms of state is a monopoly of armed force. And it's armed force that gets legitimated through the prevailing political system, the prevailing social compact, and the attendant ideological forms. And this is something that when this is the actual, the very essence, the heart and the brain of the society is it rests. It actually rests on all this. It's their ability to have the monopoly of armed force legitimated no matter what they do. And as long as people believe in that, things are working like a well-oiled machine for the system. You know, not really, but it's really – that's what they would have. It's better than what they have now in a certain sense because right now this very essence of the society, the monopoly of armed force, actually how they stay in power, this is being challenged in a place like Chicago. I mean, this is incredible where you have these – it's not stopping. It's not like – I'm not saying, oh, well, you know, it's like it's going up and it's going over and it's all this other stuff. But there is actually a major assault on the legitimacy of the system's – armed force, their rule of armed by armed force.
Yeah, and see, this is really critical because a key part of keeping any government in place is having the people that it rules over accepting the legitimacy of it utilizing armed force to keep the social order together. And the cops are a front line part of that armed force. But if people begin to feel like the cops are wantonly brutalizing and murdering people, then that the legitimacy of that monopoly of armed force is getting pulled apart. And that is happening in Chicago. This is also why the protests around police murder have been such a problem for the authorities, and they've worked so hard to try to suppress them, because what people are challenging, even though they overwhelmingly don't realize it, is that they are challenging that monopoly on the use of legitimate force in society. If they're starting to say, we don't like the way your police operate in our communities, we don't like the way that they stop and frisk people targeting blacks and Latinos. We don't like the way that they arrest people seemingly on a whim. We don't like the way they brutalize people and even kill people, and your system always lets them get away with it. That's throwing up a challenge to the legitimacy of their monopoly on armed force. And in Chicago, that challenge is becoming more and more conscious. It's becoming more and more something that people are directly throwing out there with this call for everybody up to the mayor to be out of office, and then even calls for the mayor to be facing criminal prosecution, because it's public knowledge now that the mayor knew about the video of the murder of Laquan McDonald. He denies having seen it, but he acknowledges that he knew that it existed, which would be hard for him not to, because his legal arm, the legal arm of the city government, was defending the decision of the prosecutor, because by then it was the prosecutor's job to handle this, no longer just the police's job. It was the prosecutor's job to handle it, and the prosecutor's office was refusing to make it public. So you have all of these officials implicated in it, and it's at the level now where in Chicago, they are discussing the crisis of legitimacy. Mainly, it's being discussed by the talking heads in the media about how do we keep this together? How do we get the legitimacy back? What are the steps that we need to take to do that? Which is why the police chief got fired. Somebody else stepped down. I forget who the other one was. But the mayor's drawing the line. He's not resigning. And he's going to preside over changing things. Then you have the Department of Justice saying that it's going to come in. All of this, though, really means nothing as far as stopping the problem, because these Department of Justice investigations, the Obama Justice Department has been in position about 7 years now. 7 years it's had the responsibility to police the police nationwide. Over that period, thousands upon thousands of people have been killed by police. More than 1,000 of them have been unarmed and doing nothing wrong when the police killed them. The Obama Justice Department, under first Eric Holder and then Loretta Lynch, has put zero cops on trial for having killed people. And these are all of these cops who have been exonerated by the local authorities.
the Justice Department has investigated a few dozen times and decided to put on federal trial exactly zero cops in all of these killings.
Mm-hmm. Carl, I want to interject something here because we have about 5 minutes right now.
Okay.
And I really want to make sure that we cover this last question. I know, and I appreciate it. And I think this is related. I just want to make sure that you're able to tie this in, because when you're talking about all this, it actually points to this thing about, look, we're talking about, even though this is mainly centered right now when we're talking about this legitimacy crisis or developing legitimacy crisis in Chicago, this has repercussions nationwide, not least of the matter being that Rahm Emanuel is actually one of the Obama mob, you know, and you think about this, that whole thing is linked up. But then you look at the things that you're saying, these kinds of things that are going on. And there's something I really want people to understand, something, a legitimacy crisis. It's important to recognize that what's going on and understanding how you can act on it, what it means for the struggle for people to get out of this mess that we're in, and actually what it means for a revolution, because it's not a revolutionary crisis, but it certainly is a key ingredient of one. And I want you to talk about that, especially in relation to what's going on and the moment we're facing right now.
Yeah, actually, that's important and where this needs to go, because this is really centered in Chicago now, but it actually is something that is of national importance, and because of the role the U.S. plays in the world, international importance. It's nationally significant because the same kind of thing is going on all across the country without the breaking open of resistance and the role that it played in forcing the crisis coming up. And when people begin to question the legitimacy of the monopoly on legitimate armed force in the society, they are getting right at the foundations of that setup. Legitimacy crisis can come into being and can go out of being. Maybe these steps that they're taking will draw enough people back into accepting that the system can police itself and make things right. But the reality is that none of that's going to change that. It's going to take revolution, nothing less, to end this once and for all. We should live in a society where those entrusted with public security would sooner lose their own lives than kill or injure an innocent person. But it's going to take a revolution to bring that about. And this kind of revolution is possible because of the leadership and the work that Bob Avakian has been done, pointing to how you could make revolution and bring into being societies people would want to live in. And people who want to see an end to not only this horror of police terror, but all the other horrors the system brings down, the attacks on women, the attacks on immigrants, the destruction of the environment of the planet, they need to act on these horrors. And especially this one right here around police violence disproportionately targeting Black people and other oppressed people, because this is a crucial Achilles heel of this system, a crucial vulnerability. And far from sitting back and seeing how it develops, we have to actually see that there's a role for us. We have to step up resistance on this front. We have to challenge the cover-ups and the injustice and the continued and intensifying brutality, terror, and murders that are being brought down by the police and being covered up and justified by the system, because acting on it can take a crisis of legitimacy and not only spread it and prolong it, but actually bring into being a revolutionary crisis, a crisis where the authorities can't continue to bamboozle people, oppress and exploit people in the old ways that they did, and where the people are no longer willing to be ruled over and governed in the old ways. And that creates an opening where a chance to make revolution and get rid of all of this mess actually can come into being. And those kinds of situations are rare, especially in countries like the U.S., and we can't sleep on it. In fact, we have to be acting now to go at this crisis of legitimacy, like I said, to spread it, but to be working to transform it into a crisis where the ability of the ruling class to continue to rule is being called into question and being gone at.
All right, Carl, on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up, man. But real quick, tell people how they can get in touch with you.
Okay. First off, go to the website revcom.us, where some of what we're talking about is being dealt with in articles about Chicago and other places around the country. Also, you should go to the Stop Mass Incarceration website, where there are going to be plans for moving forward off of Rise Up October. And you can hit me on Twitter at Carl_Dix, older school via email, CarlDix@Hotmail.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today, and look forward to talking to you again real soon, man.
Okay, thank you for having me on again.
All right, take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Running down a dark street, app that got a flashlight, Nike swoosh on bare feet, Whitney Houston's crack pipe. The greatest love of all, watch me rise to watch me fall, contemplating rent is laid and houses that I can't afford. Show my papers at Heaven's gates, they ask me for my visa. Lived a life without no hate, so tell me what you need to question your authority, genocide and poverty.
All right, welcome back. That was Saul Williams with Burundi. All right, right now we're going to listen to a piece from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's a piece called Yes, There's a Conspiracy to Get the Cops Off. So here's Bob Avakian.
Think about what happened to Amadou Diallo in New York. Now, Richard Pryor used to have this routine he did to show what it was like for a black man just in an ordinary encounter with the police, how you had to try to avoid being one of those mistakes where you got killed. He talked about a black man gets pulled over by the police and he has to say, I am reaching into my pocket for my license because I don't want to be no motherfucking accident. You have to show them and make clear and loud that you're going into your pocket to bring out your wallet. Otherwise, they'll say you had a gun and shoot you down. And for Amadou Diallo, even that didn't work. Amadou Diallo pulled out his wallet and held it up, and they shot him down anyway. 41 times they shot at him. They pumped his body with bullets. Or look what happened around here to Taisha Miller. The police came up on her. She was in a car, apparently passed out. Her family came up. They begged the police because the car was locked, let them find a way to open it. But no, the police couldn't wait. They fired into the car 29 times, shooting her in the back 12 times. And that wasn't the worst of it. When the family came and was grieving, the cops started mocking them with racist taunts. Oh, what is this, Kwanzaa? What is this, the Watts whale? This is America. This is the greatest of all countries. Well, what about what happened with Donovan Jackson and how the cops got off in that thing, too? They took him, they punched him in the face and slammed his head down on a car for no good reason and no reason at all. But they got off. One of them got acquitted completely and the other one, oh, you know, the jury couldn't decide. But let's not blame the jury as much as the judge and the prosecutor. Whenever they're forced to put a cop on trial for brutality or murder, all of a sudden the prosecutors forget how to prosecute. Anybody who has a case, I'm sure they say, God damn, give me that prosecutor when I got my case go up. They don't call witnesses. They don't ask the witnesses the right questions. They accept the defense theory of what happened and then argue little nitpicky things about it within that framework. The same thing happened with the Amadou Diallo case. The jury found him not guilty, and one of the jurors afterwards said, I wish we could have found him guilty. I hope they sue him, those cops, and get all kinds of money out of him. But the way the judge set it up, we had to go by the law, so we couldn't find him guilty. Well, they should have found him guilty anyway, but you know what she's saying. And the judge is part of it, too. It's part of the conspiracy. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off. What happened in the Rampart scandal, a scandal in L.A.? They shot up this dude, Latino brother. Then they accused him of assaulting the police. He comes in the court in a wheelchair. He's convicted. The judge gives him almost a maximum sentence. Why? Because he didn't show remorse. For what? He didn't do any goddamn thing. But this is the way it works. And what happened when they finally had to put these Rampart cops, or a couple of them, on trial? The judge did everything she could to get the jury not to find him guilty. But this time, the jury found him guilty anyway, so the judge threw out the verdict. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off.
All right, once again, that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it was a piece taken from his speech, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About, and you can access the entire speech at revolutiontalk.net. We're going to take a short break and be right back with Stephanie Myers, one of the co-editors of The Atheist Guide to Christmas, and writer, satirist Paul Krasner, one of the contributors to the book. So stay tuned. You definitely don't want to miss this one.
Well, I walked to town in the pouring rain, paid my fare and I rode that train to the station under the avenue, hit the air at the stroke of noon. At the cross streets where I staked my claim, I played in tune with the winter rain, collecting dimes and dollar bills while the noisy traffic played the fills, and it's Christmas time in the city.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and that was Mary Chapin Carpenter with Christmas Time in the City, a really beautiful song. And imagine this. It manages to capture the spirit of the season and, best of all, takes the holy out of holiday. In that spirit, I'm really happy to welcome our next guest to the show. Stephanie Myers is one of the editors of what I found to be one of the more fascinating books of the Christmas season, The Atheist Guide to Christmas. And Paul Krasner is one of the contributors of this, as well as being, and Paul's got a, he has got a, I don't know, I'd say he's got a bio that stretches about a football field long. And he's always been one of the people who I've looked to in the world to kind of look at and understand that there's really, both through satire and through telling the truth, he's really helped a lot of people see what reality is. He's the author of Confessions of a Raving Unconfined Nut, Misadventures in the Counterculture, and he's the recent recipient of a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Oakland branch of Penn. So, Stephanie, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Sure. Well, Stephanie, let's jump into it with you first. What the hell got into you to get into this Atheist Guide to Christmas, hmm?
Well, you know, it actually started a couple years ago with the UK Atheist Bus Campaign, where UK journalist Ariane Shireen noticed that a lot of Christian organizations were advertising on buses, and she said, you know what, why can't we do that? So she set out to raise a little bit of money and ended up raising £150,000 to do bus advertisements saying, there's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life. So at that point, it just seemed like there was the energy and the excitement to turn something like that into a book with that same sort of attitude. So that's where this came from.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get involved in it?
You know, I am closely in touch with HarperCollins UK colleagues, and so they sent over this project. And being someone who was never raised practicing a religion but who loves Christmas as well as other holidays, I mean, I'm just as excited about Halloween as Christmas, honestly. But it spoke to me, and there were such great contributors signed up and so many different types of essays and so many different ways that people still really enjoyed the holidays despite their religious affiliations or non-affiliations. So I just thought it was such a fun project.
And Paul, how about you? How did you get involved in this?
Stephanie invited me to contribute, and it was for a good cause. Stephanie can talk more about that. And it was an opportunity to see that this is another little evolutionary jump in atheism coming out of the closet. You know, I mean, when I was a kid, I got beaten up for it. It's a sign of progress in that, so I was happy to accept her invitation.
Now, you grew up in New York?
Yes.
Okay, and are you telling me that you expect me to believe that there were gangs of God-filled heathens or God-filled whatever, hooligans, not heathens, God-filled hooligans who were beating up heathens?
Well, no. It wasn't a gang. It was just like one or two guys from junior high school.
Oh, okay. Well, I got beat up by a gang of nuns, you know. That was. I also got
really?
Strangled. Yes, I got strangled by the bishop, too, when I got my confirmation because I asked the question you weren't supposed to ask. Wait a minute. How can you be three gods in one? The bishop actually slapped my face really hard, knocked me off the altar rail, and that sort of marked my exit from Catholicism. So,
huh.
Yeah.
Oh, so, yeah. No, but that's a very nice visual picture of gang of nuns.
It may be nice to talk about now, but I still have horrible, horrible nightmares about it.
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting. I mean, as an atheist, I don't have believe in a God to get mad at me. But it is a paradox, Michael, because not only am I an atheist, but I'm also an absurdist. And what could be more absurd than for an atheist to have continuing dialogue with the deity he doesn't believe exists?
And are you saying that you do that?
Oh, sure. You know, like as a stand-up satirist, when I'm in the green room waiting to go on, I'll say, please, God, help me do a good show. And then I'll hear the voice of God say, shut up, you superstitious fool.
Okay, there's so much to unravel about that, Paul. I don't know where to begin. We're talking with writer and satirist Paul Krassner, one of the contributors to The Atheist Guide to Christmas, and Stephanie Myers, a co-editor of the book. Stephanie, Paul mentioned the idea that atheists actually, and who knows whether this is absolutely true, but atheists, and I know from my own experience and having been an atheist for a very long time, but also talking with other people around it, and I've talked with P.Z. Myers about this, there's a tendency, not only are atheists, like in this country in particular, really cowled, or there's that idea that they're the most hated minority in the country, but there's really, people are not very aggressive and assertive when it comes to their atheist beliefs. And in Britain and in Europe, it's a little bit of a different story, but you've gotten a number of people from the U.S. to actually contribute to this atheist guide. How did you find doing that? How did you find the people to do that?
You know, it's funny. I was responsible for bringing in more U.S. contributors. And, of course, I had my list of big names, and then I wanted to find more up-and-coming writers, and I was literally just Googling, you know, lists of up-and-coming atheists or, you know, lists of feminist atheists and just trying to find great people who are talking. Like one person, Jennifer McCrate, who blogs at blaghag.com. She's a young grad student, and I think she's just brilliant and someone to keep an eye on, so I was really excited about finding that. But I would say I'm someone who's totally guilty of being an in-the-closet atheist. And until I worked on this project, I just hadn't thought about it. It was something that didn't come up in life ever. And so working on this, I've really started to see that there's some point to talking a little bit more about it. And it's been an interesting evolution for me. And I'm excited to bring that to other people because really it's such a tame-looking book, right? It's a great entryway if someone isn't feeling aggressive about it and really doesn't want to commit to a longer, more in-depth book. This is a great thing to start off and get a sense of who's writing in this space.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's sort of, yes, the book is, you know, it's got snowflakes on the front. It says The Atheist Guide to Christmas, and you put featuring Richard Dawkins and a number of other people. And then when you open it up, it actually is a lot different than what I expected to find, actually. I mean, I really enjoyed all of the various stories. Now, I'd ask you, leaving aside Paul for a moment, what is one of your favorite stories in here?
I really love Simon Singh's piece, which is about celebrating a different birth, which is the birth of the universe at Christmas. And I think it's a great mixture of good writing and good science. And that's really one of my favorites.
Now, Paul, in your piece, you actually, I mean, it's very interesting because you don't just talk about yourself developing as an atheist, although I found that really fascinating and funny, but I also felt you also did something that was very horrifying, which is, and revealing, when you talked about the title of your piece is There's No Atheists in the White House. Can you talk about some of the things that you revealed in that, which I thought are mind-blowing, because people don't know this stuff about the presidents and their conversations with this non-existent deity?
Yes, well, I did some research because there was so much religious piety coming out of the White House, and my attitude towards believers is not hostile, because whether they use it as a crutch or they believe it sincerely, my turning point was when, because I was more militant then than I am now, but what was my turning point was that Martin Luther King was a Christian, and he was a kind, moral activist, humane, whereas at the same time, George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the head of the American Nazi Party, called himself an agnostic. So the tipping point for me was to start just relating to people not by what they believed, but that how they related to humans and animals and the earth. And so I don't categorize that. And so in my research, and but I did believe that people who thought that God actually talked to them were deluded, including George Bush. And then in my research, I found out that his father said the same kind of things, an atheist shouldn't be in the White House, that went back to Lyndon Johnson, you know, it was, and there were others, and there's only one, Abby Hoffman once told me, Abby Hoffman, the late activist and co-founder of the Yippies, started out as another co-founder, Jerry Rubin did, working within the system, and Abby was supporting some candidate in Boston, and somebody asked the candidate about religion, and he said, oh, I'm an atheist, and the reporters started walking out, they said, okay, there goes the ball game. And so currently now, I think Pete Stark is the only, I guess, as you say, openly gay, openly atheistic in the entire legislature. So, and there were laws in some states. In the article, I mentioned specifically in different states where they said that nobody could be a candidate if they didn't profess a belief in God. So it shows the background of the kind of thing that religion and politics are in the same bed together. And you know, and they always had Billy Graham come there. And even when Richard Nixon, one of the tapes revealed, was saying some of his anti-Semitic remark, Billy Graham agreed. You know, and that's as bad as saying itself. I wrote to the Anti-Defamation League about that and never heard back.
Yeah, well, it's interesting how much comes out of the mouths of these God-fearing people. I mean, it's even, you know, you have General Boykin, and you have all the thing that happened in Fallujah, where people were, these commanders in Iraq were demand, you know, as they're committing this horrific slaughter, and one of the worst war crimes in the Iraq War in Fallujah, and they're talking about that the face of Satan is in there, and they're going to go in and defeat Satan for God, you know, and it's, I mean, this kind of thing that develops here, it's interesting to me because you have the most, and even with Bush, when you were talking about Bush's father in your article, you actually make the point that George Bush the First actually made the point not just that people shouldn't occupy the White House, but he doesn't know that atheists should be considered citizens.
Well, you know, there was one thing. Oh, you mentioned that I got the Penn Lifetime Achievement Award, and so in my speech, I always knew, I made a vow to myself that if I ever got an award like that, this is what I would do. And so I said, you know, you don't get a Lifetime Achievement Award for just doing everything alone. You know, you collaborated with people, you were supported by people and nurtured. And I said, and I would like to thank these people in chronological order, starting with my parents, and who were embarrassed by what I wrote and even ashamed of it. But nevertheless, you know, I was editing The Realist, which was considered by others as the hippest magazine in America, but I was still living with my parents. Okay, so I said, but first and foremost, I don't know about, many of you don't know too much about my spiritual quest. And so, first of all, I would like to thank Satan. And and the people who knew me there, you know, laughed. But there were, you know, various book awards, and the people who came for that, they were silent because there was no way to tell that that I wasn't being sincere. And I mean, in fact, I have said to people, you know, when they read it in the San Francisco Chronicle and knew about it, and they asked me about it, and I said, well, you know, it was a tough competition, but I beat out Justin Bieber. And a lot of people said, oh, yeah, yes, and he's only 14. I said, yes, but he's writing his memoir.
Okay, all right, that's a good one there. We're talking with Stephanie Myers, one of the co-editors of The Atheist Guide to Christmas, and to writer and satirist Paul Krassner, one of the contributors to this anthology. Paul, just one more quick question for you at the moment is, you know, people, Stephanie talked about her own sort of being reticent about coming out with her atheism. You actually became an atheist in a way. Becoming an atheist actually introduced you to a whole other world of, it seemed, in what you described in the article. It really was a sort of a process that brought you into a whole other social world that really seemed to have an effect on shaping the rest of your life.
That's true. You know, it was a religious experience, is that's the irony of it. But I had been, because you can see, trace the chain of events that led you to it. But I started out in college in a philosophy course. I had to do a paper, and I wanted to do one on a dialogue between Plato and an atheist. And just on a whim, I looked up atheism in the telephone book, and there it was. You know, they put the word that you're looking up left. So it was Atheist American Association of, 4 A's. And I found that I went to a little office there, and they were met the editor of their paper, The Truth Seeker, which later became an anti-Semitic hate rag, but, you know, because it, when he died, they got a different editor. But they had an ism forum, which was to talk about all the different isms at a little dinky, the Algonquin Hotel, you might remember that.
Yeah.
It was very funky, and it was in a big ballroom with chairs all around the perimeter, and then one little stage there. And so I went to that and met people there, and they went to a restaurant for a thing, and then they told me about the Rationalist Society, so I went to another meeting, and there was the MC for that evening was a former circus performer who could hold four golf balls in his mouth and demonstrated it. You know, I said, so this is atheism. And he mentioned a paper called The Independent, and I went and got to the office of The Independent and met Lyle Stewart, who was the biggest influence of my life. He, too, was an atheist, and he edited a paper that was the forerunner of the alternative press, and I started out stuffing envelopes there and became the managing editor, and out of that developed The Realist, which was essentially the banner logo on the front was a free thought criticism and satire. So it started out with that, and the first subscriber was Steve Allen, who bought several subscriptions for others, and then one of whom was Lenny Bruce, and Lenny sent out subscriptions to a lot of people. It grew in a Malthusian way, and Lenny became the other big influence in my life as a satirist, and I ended up editing his autobiography. So in answer to your question, that there was this chain of events that I label as random destiny.
All right. You know, and I have to tell you, Paul, when I was a kid, I was reading The Realist because there was only one kid in my neighborhood, Lenny Dicardi, and his parents they gave him permission to actually get that all the time, and he would share it with me, and we used to sit in his basement and read that, and it was incredible, including there were some that just you'd left you sitting there with your mouth open. You know, it was so mind blowing just to read it. So I wanted to thank you for that. Yeah, it's really.
You know, you just painted a beautiful picture. I can picture it, almost like a Norman Rockwell.
Yeah, exactly.
But through the basement window, you can see a gang of nuns rushing at you.
Right. You got it exactly. Oh, you had to bring those nuns up again. Now, Stephanie, one more question for you. You had, and I have to say, when you mentioned Jennifer McCrate. Her gift for the godless is priceless, and I won't say anything more about it, but people really have to check this out. And I would say something I want to read before we go, but I want to ask you one question, one of my favorite essays in here is the one by Brian Cox, which I think is very similar to what you were talking about, but I just found there's a whole part of the end that really I think is really good. I wanted to ask you this, the idea that you brought together such a wide array of people, from Paul, who actually, I mean, as we're talking about, it's very humorous. There's a lot of satire involved in his, and there's a lot of truth-telling. You also bring physicists. You bring scientists into it. You bring political forces into it. You bring comedians into it. You know, how did you, that kind of vision, what kind of response have you gotten to it? How did you actually bring these people together or develop that kind of vision to have that breadth of view? And then what's the response been?
You know, I have to give a lot of credit to Robin, who is my co-editor, who did a lot, almost more of the legwork than I did. But really, once people found out about it, a lot of people wanted to be involved. And word sort of spread through the atheist/skeptic community, and we were contacted by people who wanted to volunteer as well. So it actually was maybe much easier than it looked because so many people from so many different areas of expertise, once they heard about it, really wanted to join in. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Paul, Stephanie, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today.
Oh, it was delightful. Anytime.
And we'll have you back. Okay. Take care now. Great. And happy holidays.
One thing, Michael. God bless you.
Okay. You did it again. There are those nuns charging through the door. Thanks, Paul. See you later now. Talk to you later. All right. Well, we've run out of time, so we've got to be real quick. I want to thank everybody who was involved in the production of this and everybody who's listening. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
The silvery sound of sleigh bells, the rap of reindeer hoofs, a man all clothed in crimson, he runs from roof to roof. He clambers down the chimneys, leaves toys neath all the trees, till anyone home, the lights flick on, and someone yells out, freeze, Santa's doing time.